This is Freemasonry Today magazine, issue number 52 for winter 2020. The magazine editor is Donna Hardy. The editorial panel is Michelle Warvell, Guy Roberts, Sean Butler, Dean Simmons, Barry Hughes, and Julian Perry is the culture editor. FMT magazine is published by Sunday at 207 Union Street, London, SE10LN. On the web as We Are Sunday, WEARESUNDAY.com, for the United Grand Lodge of England, situated at Freemasons Hall, Great Queen Street, London, WC2B5AZ. You can contact for Masonic inquiries editor at freemasonrytoday.com. Telephone 020-7831-9811. On the web at www.ugle.org.uk. Now a look at the upcoming contents of this issue of the magazine, starting with the welcome, which would be on page 3. That's from the Grand Secretary and the Grand Scribe E. Dr. David Staples welcomes you to the winter issue. And then we get to Out and About, which is news and views from the provinces, this time Freemasonry in the face of COVID-19. The next section, Stories, starts on page 18 with four articles. Open House London, Freemasons Hall, warmly and safely welcomed the public to this annual event. 60 Seconds With this time is Dave Wheeler, Provincial Grand Master and Grand Superintendent for Lincolnshire. Page 24, Brave to the End, a fond farewell to Freemason Bob Smith. And the Brother Podcast, Putting the Fun into Freemasonry, that's on page 26. A daily advancement section has three things in it. QC writes, Dr. Rick Berman, on ancients and moderns. On the side, the Order of the Scarlet Cord and Museum of Freemasonry. Periodicals give a glimpse into the past. The Grand Lodge section has Lest We Forget, Freemasons Hall is lit in remembrance. Learnings in Lockdown, the virtual annual Solomon Conference. Quarterly Communication, Pro-Grand Master Peter Lowndes on the changes afoot for Freemasonry. Members Pathway, a new team for a new stage, and welcoming you back. The museum puts safety for visitors first. The Royal Arch section has an interview with Stephen Tucker. Meet the President of the Committee of General Purposes in Supreme Grand Chapter. And Stuck with Sussex Fudge, Should We Redefine or Embrace It? The culture section has book reviews, and we round this section off with letters to the editor.
On page 3, from the Grand Secretary and Grand Scribe E. Before I moved to Cambridgeshire, I sang at Southall Minster. The 30-minute journey from my home took me through the farmlands of Nottinghamshire, and I found myself noticing the changing of the seasons much more than in my previous city existence. The crops being sown and harvested, lambs suddenly appearing in the spring and disappearing in late summer, the bare fields giving way to pasture, and the cycle of life starting over again. For a decade or so, this rhythm seeped into me, and I began to take great comfort in the fact that, whatever else was going on in my life, there was a solid predictability in the land and seasons that surrounded me. Freemasonry also imparts a rhythm to life. The unfamiliarity of those first few meetings, the curious words, and all those strangers gradually giving way to lifelong friendships, the measured transformation from the unexpected to the comforting. A yearly cycle of election, installation, well-performed ceremonies, and good meals afterwards seeps into us all, month after month, year after year, decade after decade, as it did our many predecessors over the centuries. I didn't realise quite how much I missed it and relied upon it until all of a sudden it changed and stopped. Of course, those of us who come through the pandemic with only the disruption of a well-loved hobby to show for it would do well to consider ourselves very fortunate. For many, including members of our own lodges and chapters, things may have been significantly worse. Many have lost their jobs or their loved ones. Some have even lost their homes or the businesses they have built up over decades. Relationships have been strained. Some may have been broken and, for many, latent anxieties, long suppressed in the regular rhythm of daily life, have bubbled unbidden to the surface. As the nights draw in and we look forward to perhaps a stranger Christmas period than usual, we remember Thomas Fuller's famous quote, "The night is always darkest just before the dawn." Complete nonsense literally, but metaphorically we all know what he meant. If predictions and models hold true, the pandemic is, at last, more behind us than ahead, and 2021 will be the year when things get back to normal. We may not know exactly when, but it is enough to know that with each passing day, these strange times are drawing to a close. We will meet again, as we used to, before the year is out. For many of us, myself included, this will involve picking up a ritual book for the first time in a while and learning those things I should have learnt 10 months ago. Prevarication, for once, paying off. Lodge committees will be wondering when to start planning for normality, and traditions, so often defined as those things insisted on by the director of ceremonies before the current one, will be dusted off and relied upon to justify all sorts. Yet things will not be the same. We have all been changed by the experiences of the past year, and the way we do things has changed too, perhaps forever. Many lodges and chapters have been forced to confront those same traditions and adapt them to serve the circumstances, realizing in the teeth of adversity that tradition should always be our servant, never our master. Successful organizations adapt and overcome whatever chance or circumstance can throw at them, and there can be few organizations so successful as Freemasonry. Dynasties have waxed and waned while our ancient order was still in its youth. It has stood firm above that deluge that swept away the men and the institutions contemporaneous with its rise, but even now, in these trying times, it is not some ruin or wreck of past greatness. On the contrary, our members are numerous and found the world over. Our resources are ample, and our means exist in every county, city, and town in the land. The reason for this great success? Because Freemasonry teaches the same lessons, inculcates the same principles, as it did in the remote days of its foundation. Those lessons, and more importantly, their worth, have been weighed in the balance of more than 300 years and have not been found wanting. As we begin a new chapter in our history, as I am sure the passing of this pandemic will mark, let us embrace our future boldly, rekindling the rhythm of our Masonic lives, as together we rekindle our lodges and chapters. We are safe in the knowledge that we are part of an institution that has weathered greater storms than this, whose members have drawn strength and support from coming together to share the good times and the bad, both in their own lives and the life of the nation, and who will continue to do so until time with us all shall be no more. Dr. David Staples, Grand Secretary and Grand Scribe E.
Page 6 begins the Out and About section of the magazine. This is a roundup of what's happening in the world of Freemasonry from both nationwide and some of the individual provinces. We start with a nationwide story, In Memoriam. The recent tragic death of Sergeant Matthew Matt Ratana of the Metropolitan Police Service deeply saddened the England Freemasons rugby team and community. Matt was a huge rugby fan and was the head coach of East Grinstead RFC. The club said Matt was an irreplaceable figure, while his partner of 6 years paid tribute to her gentle giant with an infectious smile. This all inspired the England Freemasons Rugby Football Club to set up a Just Giving appeal for members to raise funds for his family. As of writing, the amount so far is more than £5,000. Committee member Rab Cooper said the England Freemasons Rugby Committee was deeply moved by this tragic incident. Police officers up and down the country are dealing with the worst of society, run towards danger, and sadly sometimes make the ultimate sacrifice. To honour Sergeant Ratana's memory, we were determined to do something to raise funds. We are utterly astonished just how successful this appeal has been. We've received donations from across the country, including the Channel Islands, and would like to thank each and every person who has donated. Rab went on to say, we used at England Masons RFC Twitter account to spread awareness, and this was picked up by UGLE. Their very kind retweets of our posts helped us far exceed our original hopes of £1,000, with that figure continuing to grow. The England Freemasons Rugby Team is a group set up to encourage Freemasons to play rugby union for their province or for the England Freemasons National Team, who next year will be taking on the Welsh Freemasons team in a rearranged fixture.
Number 2. East Lancashire. Peak condition. Manchester Freemasons have raised £8,500 for local charity St Anne's Hospice. It all began when Dean Lynch was discussing ideas for fundraising that the Manchester Level Club, MLC, could undertake during the COVID-19 lockdown. They decided that the MLC would complete the Yorkshire Three Peaks Challenge, supported by Manchester Masons, with an initial fundraising target of £2,500. Fast forward to a 6 a.m. Saturday morning in August 2020, when a group of Manchester Freemasons and guests gathered in the picturesque village of Horton in Ribblesdale, just within the Yorkshire Dales. After being briefed by former Royal Marine and expert guide Chris Ainsley from Optimal Adventures, the group proceeded to take on the 27-mile walk in hot conditions, all wearing heavy backpacks. The first ascent the team tackled was Penny Ghent. At 2,227 feet, the fell is the lowest of the Yorkshire Three Peaks, but still a stiff climb. After conquering the first summit, the group began the slog to get to the top of the second and highest of the three peaks, Wernside, 2,415 feet. After a brief celebration, the group set off for the final peak, Ingleborough, 2,347 feet. The walk raised £7,000, not including gift aid, and a cheque was presented to the CEO of St Anne's Hospice, Eamon O'Neill, who was also the current High Sheriff of Manchester.
Number 3. West Lancashire. Nourish and nurture. West Lancashire Freemasons have donated £29,000 to a local youth club and received another contribution to their MCF 2021 festival appeal. When Provincial Grand Master Tony Harrison and Assistant Provincial Grand Master Andy Whittle visited Warrington Youth Club, they were there for two reasons. The first was to visit the Peace Centre, where the Youth Club is housed, with a donation from the Masonic Charitable Foundation, MCF, the Freemasons charity, and to see how the money was being used. The second reason was to meet with Garston Group Chairman John Murphy and his ever-active festival representative Jim Corcoran to receive a donation from the Garston and Walton Group for the MCF 2021 festival. Thanks to the grant from West Lancashire Freemasons to the Warrington Youth Club, 50 local children who are experiencing poverty, social isolation, and who have been at risk of holiday hunger during the school breaks are being given the support they need. The money will support a three-year programme. The charity runs a Boost Holiday Club, which offers activities and healthy meals during the school holidays. Free places at the club are offered discreetly to local families in need and includes return transport to the club, a healthy breakfast and lunch, and a timetable of activities that promote social, health and life skills. Warrington Youth Club has been supporting children and young people through quality activities since the 1930s. The charity was originally set up by a group of mothers who were concerned about their children getting into trouble after school. Based on the ethos of inspiring young people to achieve, the charity has developed into the largest youth provision in Warrington and today works with more than 2,500 children and young people.
Number 4. Cambridgeshire. Care in a crisis. Cambridge Samaritans are being supported through the COVID-19 crisis thanks to a grant from Cambridgeshire Freemasons. The £2,000 grant is especially welcome as the Samaritans' fundraising ability has been reduced by the lockdown, but their local volunteers are still receiving 80 calls or more every day, which works out at one every 18 minutes. The Samaritans have used the money from the grant to reorganise their working arrangements to keep staff and volunteers safe, as well as increasing their capacity to respond to calls and emails by investing in new technology. They are also looking at introducing instant messaging as another way for people in distress to be able to contact them. The COVID-19 pandemic has been expensive for Cambridge Samaritans. They have already had to spend around £4,000 on antiviral wipes, sprays, hand gel and other costs to adapt their working practices so that essential services can continue during the crisis period. John Humpston, director of Cambridge Samaritans, said, "We're very grateful to Cambridgeshire Freemasons for helping to sustain the branch during the pandemic and, by extension, our service to callers. We get many calls arising from the stresses created by the virus, and with essential telephony, hygiene and social distancing changes, the grant from the Freemasons has helped us to keep going."
Rescue Remedy. This is number 5, Suffolk. Suffolk Royal Archmasons have donated a total of £20,000 to Suffolk Accident Rescue Service, SARS, after David Boswell decided to adopt the charity for his 2020 Grand Superintendent's appeal. The chapters of Suffolk responded in true Masonic spirit, and together with match funding from the Suffolk Provincial Grand Chapter Charity, they raised £10,000, which David presented to Dr. Fiona Virgo on behalf of Suffolk's Royal Archmasons. He was accompanied by his wife Jenny, together with Mike and Gwen Caddock and their granddaughter Lucy, who tested the emergency vehicle's blue lights. The operations manager gave an overview of the work of the charity, which on average responds to 6 medical emergencies or trauma incidents every week. In a quarter of the call-outs, SARS is the first on the scene. Dr. Virgo demonstrated an automatic CPR resuscitation machine, which costs some £8,000 to buy and maintain. In emergencies, it frees the SARS clinician working single-handedly to treat and comfort the patient while the machine helps restart circulation and breathing. The efforts of Suffolk's Royal Archmasons received a tremendous boost in early September when, with the support of Provincial Grandmaster Ian Yeldham, the Masonic Charitable Foundation agreed to match the money raised and made the total £20,000.
Number 6. Devonshire. Bear hugs all round. Teddy's for Loving Care, TLC, has marked a quadruple celebration in the province of Devonshire. First, there were smiles all round when the Deputy Provincial Grand Master for Devonshire, Nick Ball, and Assistant Provincial Grand Masters Peter Keaty and Craig Cox met to celebrate the births of their granddaughters, Edie Violet, Eleanor and Tilly, who were all born within weeks of each other. The gathering was also an opportunity to celebrate the news that the Devonshire Teddies for Loving Care appeal has achieved registered charity status with the Charity Commission and HM Revenue and Customs, as well as to support the work of TLC. The Teddies for Loving Care appeal started in 2001 in the province of Essex, but quickly grew to become a national initiative, entirely funded by Freemasons and their families, who also volunteer their time to run the scheme. The objective of the initiative is to provide teddy bears for staff in medical and other care establishments to give to young children in distress following a trauma or sickness. The TLC teddy bears help relieve suffering and reduce shock and distress. The bears are not only used by medical staff to help reduce the children's stress and fear levels, but also to reward them for being brave, and in some cases explain and demonstrate medical procedures. Every child gets to keep their bear. In Devonshire, the initiative started in 2008 under local Devon coordinator John Adcock, supported by past Assistant Provincial Grand Master, Worshipful Brother Christopher Yard. In recent years, the initiative has gone from strength to strength under the direction of Keith Bauer, supported by Assistant Provincial Grand Master Charles Yelland. In the province of Devonshire, an amazing 59,000 teddy bears have been donated to 11 hospital accident and emergency units at Derriford, Torbay, Royal Devon and Exeter and North Devon hospitals and children's wards, children's specialist care units and children's hospices right across the province. Support and enthusiasm for the initiative continues to grow in Devonshire, so it was decided earlier this year that the initiative would benefit from being reshaped into a charitable trust so that registered charity status could be achieved to further develop a regional focus across the province. Registered charity status was granted by the Charity Commission and accepted by HMRC in August 2020, with one of the immediate benefits of registration being that donations can now be made under the Gift Aid scheme, which boosts every £1 donated by a further 25p.
Next we come to Leicestershire and Rutland, saddling up for charity. Leicestershire and Rutland Freemasons recently completed a cycle ride for charity. Three members of East Goscote Lodge number 2865 took to the saddle to raise funds. After months of training, Nathan Patterson, Shale Marshall and Vijay Chuan set off on a journey from Syston to Skegness. The support team of Pete Leatherland and Pete Leatherland Sr. were on hand to ensure that they had everything they needed for the journey, and the cyclists were given a rapturous send-off by the watching crowd, including the provincial grandmaster Peter Kinder and the chairman of the 2022 festival, Dale Page. The route took the cyclists eastwards through to Grantham for a well-earned rest before pushing on towards Skegness. So far, they've raised more than £2,000 for the Leicestershire and Rutland 2022 Festival, which has a target of raising £1.8 million for the MCF.
Number 8. Staffordshire. Floral Tribute. In October, the head of Staffordshire Freemasons, John Lockley, and his deputy, David Thomas, visited Wilson Keys Court in Rugeley, a Masonic sheltered housing complex for the elderly. The visit was to collect a box of knitted poppies, which, when added to those made by members and partners of Staffordshire Freemasonry, totaled more than 400. The oldest poppy knitter residing at Wilson Keys, Ivy Meehan, who is 99 years old, handed over the poppies to a delighted John and David. These poppies were sent to the United Grand Lodge of England in London to help form the centre of the celebrations commemorating 75 years since the end of World War II. John and David were joined by the High Sheriff of Staffordshire, Commander Charles Baggett Jewett, who presented John with his Certificate of Appreciation for his highly valued services to the community of Staffordshire during the COVID-19 pandemic. John accepted it on behalf of all Staffordshire Freemasons. The award was recommended by the Lord Lieutenant for Staffordshire, Mr. Ian Dudson, CBE. The High Sheriff was keen to learn of the COVID-19 support by Freemasons and of Phase 2 of the support, releasing a further £1 million through the MCF.
Next, number 9, Refuge from Abuse, and this is Lincolnshire. Lincolnshire Freemasons have given £5,000 to help victims of domestic abuse. The money is going to Lincolnshire's EDAN, the EDAN, Lines Domestic Abuse Service, and will be used to make 100 packs of essentials for victims and their children who come to any of the 21 refuges it operates countywide. Lucy is a fundraising coordinator at EDAN Lincolnshire. That's EDAN stands for Ending Domestic Abuse Now Lincolnshire. EDAN Lincolnshire. She said, "This money will provide useful resources to people who access our services after fleeing domestic abuse by means of packages tailored to individual needs as they arrive in refuge. The packages will be to the value of about £50 and could include bedding, toiletries, toys and games for children and other essential items, whatever's appropriate to the family. Many people arrive in refuge with only their clothes on their backs, having fled their home in an emergency, so this funding will be a huge help for them on their journey to starting a new life free from abuse. The donation was from the COVID-19 fund set up by the Masonic Charitable Foundation, the Freemasons charity, and it was part of a £30,000 shared between six East Midland provinces to support refuges helping victims of domestic abuse to turn their lives around."
Number 10. Guernsey and Alderney. Island Life. The annual communication of the province of Guernsey and Alderney took place, attended by 145 members, a quarter of the total membership of the province. Sadly, the ongoing COVID-19 situation meant that no visitors from other provinces were able to attend. Provincial Grand Master Keith Reed told the assembly how very lucky the COVID-free province was to be able to meet in this way. And on behalf of all those present, he expressed sympathy and best wishes for a speedy relief from their suffering under the pandemic to members everywhere, particularly those in England and Wales.
Number 11, North Wales. Care in the community. Members of Cambria Meridian Lodge of Installed Masters, number 9876, recently visited Rill Men's Shed to donate £2,000, including £1,100 from North Wales Freemasons Charity, to further their ongoing community support during the COVID-19 pandemic. Cambria Meridian Lodge, based at Ellen Hall in Rill, was established in November 2012 and meet quarterly. While unable to do so at the moment, it was decided they would reach out to help a local charity. Shane Owen, chairperson of Rill Men's Shed, said, "We provide a safe, supportive and friendly environment for men, women and children of all ages, backgrounds and capabilities to gather together and potter, tend the garden and polytunnel, do woodwork, craft and art projects, IT projects or whatever else they're interested in. We are extremely grateful to North Wales Freemasons for this generous donation."
Number 12. Surrey. A salute to VJ Day. The Prince of Wales recently led a two-minute silence at the National Memorial Arboretum in Staffordshire as part of a service of remembrance. Veterans of the Burma campaign and their families sat on chairs spaced out on the grass between the trees. Among them was Roy Miller, a 96-year-old Burma Star veteran who is a member of Stoneleigh Coronation and North Surrey First Principles chapters. Veteran Roy joined the Royal Navy aged 15 and served in the Gunnery Division on board the aircraft carrier HMS Indomitable in the Far East. More than 71,000 British and Commonwealth troops died in that campaign, including 13,000 who died in prisoner of war camps. In his speech, the Prince of Wales said many of the soldiers, nurses and other personnel felt anger and disappointment at how they were treated when they finally returned home from a war which, from the general public's point of view, had ended on the 8th of May 1945, VE Day. He added, "Let us affirm, they and serving veterans are not forgotten. Rather, you are respected, thanked and cherished with all our hearts and for all time." The proceedings focused on the multinational and multicultural makeup of the Allied forces that fought the Japanese. Gurkhas, alongside Sikhs, sat next to troops from Welsh and Scottish regiments, representing the 40 nations involved in the war in the Far East. Those who could stand were invited to do so for a two-minute silence. The Prince of Wales then laid a wreath at the Burma Railway Memorial. Roy was interviewed by Sky News and said poignantly, "People often ask if I celebrated when it all ended, but it wasn't joy at all. It was relief. It was an end. It was a feeling of relief that the whole thing was coming to an end and we weren't going to be shot at anymore."
Number 13, Berkshire, reaching out. With the assistance of the Masonic Charitable Foundation, Berkshire Freemasons donated more than £9,000 to four charities in the county to help them support local communities. They include West Berkshire Carers Hub, a grant of £2,000, will help Wokingham-based West Berkshire Carers Hub to purchase tablets to help relieve isolation. The tablets are going to carers and helpers to provide support to families and individuals who cannot get out. Due to current restrictions, the support groups and drop-in sessions are stopped, and these tablets will be invaluable in keeping in touch. Berkshire Women's Aid, a grant of £5,000 was given to Berkshire Women's Aid, BWA, who support victims, women, children and families who are or have experienced domestic abuse. This grant is helping them purchase furniture for some of the six additional homes they opened during the pandemic period, these homes offer a safe and secure setting for the victims of domestic violence. The Link Visiting Scheme. The charity normally runs a number of activities and social events to support elderly people, as well as running a befriending service to help relieve loneliness. These activities are currently suspended. A grant of £1,000 via the MCF will go towards making up goodie bags containing puzzles, treats and games for lonely and vulnerable old people. And finally, Reading Mencap. Reading Mencap provides services throughout the county to children and adults with learning difficulties. The health crisis has, however, severely restricted what they can do. It has not stopped the requirement for their services, but they do need to be delivered in new ways. Specialised activity packs, tailored to individual needs, have been created, but support is needed to get them to be delivered. The number of people requesting the packs has jumped from 45 to 80 in the past few weeks. A grant of £1,200 through the Berkshire COVID-19 Fund will help cover the cost of delivering these packs.
Number 14. West Kent. Flying high. The provincial Grand Master of the province of West Kent, Mark Estor, presented a cheque for £4,000 to the Kent and Sussex Air Ambulance Trust on behalf of the Masonic Charitable Foundation, MCF. He was accompanied by Carl Lawton of Camellia Thea Lodge and Fernando Caicedo of Westwood Lodge and their families. To the children's disappointment, the air ambulance was unable to make an appearance due to weather conditions. However, they had a number of specially equipped cars on standby, one of which was crewed by paramedic Ben McCauley and Dr. Maya Gavrilovsky, who received the cheque on the Trust's behalf. Without the generous donations of organisations like the MCF, they said, "We would be unable to offer our life-saving service to the people of Kent, Surrey and Sussex 24 hours of every day of every year."
Now we go up to Northumberland for number 15. On the ball. Golfers from across Northumberland province took on members from the neighbouring province of Durham for the annual Joseph Miller Cup. The competition this year was hosted by Northumberland at the splendid Burgham Park Golf Club. Northumberland went into the day optimistic that their home team advantage would help them towards victory, but it was not to be. Durham retained the trophy with a 380-344 win. Northumberland team captain for the day, Eric Longstaff, presented the trophy. All money raised was being donated to the Masonic COVID-19 appeal. Congratulations, Durham.
Number 16. Metropolitan. Facing the future. Back in the middle of April 2020, barely a month into the Masonic suspension and the nationwide social lockdown, Phase 1 of the joint UGLE/MCF response to the coronavirus pandemic was launched. This was to address the rapidly emerging needs of huge swathes of our communities in terms of mental health, personal isolation, the lack of basic day-to-day living essentials, and the urgent and pressing need for a whole range of personal protective equipment. PPE. In response, Assistant Metropolitan Grand Master Very Worshipful Brother Andrew Manasseh assembled a London COVID-19 Response Group, LCRG, to deliver on a variety of initiatives, including purchase and deliver 115 Samsung Galaxy tablets for the intensive care units of 24 London hospitals, donate £25,000 for West London Masonic Centre to cook and deliver 800 meals per week to local vulnerable people. Donate £20,000 to the Felix Project and City Harvest London. With the growing awareness that PPE would play a vital role in helping keep safe the army of frontline clinical workers, one of the boldest initiatives of the LCRG was devised in conjunction with the provinces of Surrey, Sussex, East and West Kent, to commission, manufacture and ship a large quantity of face visors from China to help protect these key workers. A team of Metropolitan Deputy Grand Directors of Ceremonies were tasked with identifying needy establishments within the capital who were struggling to source protective face visors and then coordinate and manage the delivery of the visors. It was agreed with Brother Andrew that London Hospital Intensive Care Units, hospices and non-profit care homes would be contacted once the visors were on UK soil and definitive lists were compiled for this purpose. Members of both the Metropolitan Grand Steward's Lodge and Chapter were approached to assist in this endeavour, and a small army of volunteers was assembled to make calls to the potential recipients or personally deliver the visors. Other London members volunteered their time too. Once the visors were ready, there followed a fortnight of air cargo slots being gazumped or missed due to frantic and fever pitch activity on the ground in China. It was quickly accepted that the most reliable method of delivery would be by sea, so cargo space was secured. The boxes were loaded onto a cargo ship at the port of Shanghai, and the visors travelled 11,866 nautical miles on a 49-day sea journey on board the proverbial slow boat from China. London's 36,700 visors, at a cost of 95 pence each, eventually arrived at Freemasons Hall in the middle of July, and were stored in the anteroom of the gallery suite. A total of 183 boxes, each containing 200 visors, with a combined gross weight of more than 13 tons. By the time the visors were ready for delivery, London Hospital ICUs had confirmed they had enough PPE, but London hospices and non-profit care homes were still reporting chronic shortages. 30 London members then began the mammoth task of calling each one of the 355 identified potential recipients to establish if they had a need for the visors, and if they did, to arrange delivery. 16 volunteer drivers, all London Freemasons, were given a dispatch list, designed, where possible, to incorporate destinations within a few miles radius of where they lived. Each driver was responsible for arranging suitable delivery dates and times with his recipients. Each volunteer driver was personally met at Freemasons Hall, in a socially distanced manner, by a member of the Metropolitan Deputy Grand Director of Ceremonies team, thanked for their time and efforts, and handed their boxes. Despite the punishing summer heatwave, every recipient who requested visors received their allocation. The hugely successful appeals for the London Air Ambulance, the Cyberknife, the London Ambulance Rapid Response Vehicles, and the most recent London Fire Brigade Aerial Platforms appeal provided essential hardware and technology to enable London's frontline workers to help keep us safe. The visor initiative went one step further by providing personal protection for the frontline workers themselves, something greatly appreciated by them as they continue to work in the most challenging of environments and circumstances. It was an incredible and rewarding experience to be a cog within a wheel of so many moving parts, driven entirely by the dedication, energy and commitment of London Freemasons. As volunteers, we came together as friends and members as part of the wider London Masonic family, and it was more of a privilege than a duty to be involved in this wonderful initiative. In the midst of these scary, changeable and unprecedented times that currently exist, the core values of Freemasonry were called upon, and a small army of London Freemasons modestly heeded the call on behalf of every London member, companion, lodge and chapter.
And finally, in this out and about section, meet and greet. Freemasons in England demonstrate that the show must go on, albeit with just 6 members. Back in September, the Grand Secretary and Grand Scribe E, Dr. David Staples, wrote to all metropolitan and provincial Freemasons, setting out guidance in relation to the Rule of 6. He said, following a meeting of the craft rulers and the Standing Committee of the Board of General Purposes, and in consultation with the Royal Arch rulers and the President of the Committee of General Purposes, it has been decided to restrict English lodge and chapter meetings to no more than 6 attendees. Before the November lockdown came into force, many Freemasons returned to lodge meetings across England under the Rule of 6, while Freemasons in Wales were unable to meet throughout this entire period. We'd like to celebrate this show goes on spirit by putting a spotlight on just some of those lodges who persevered with their meetings in reduced numbers. And on the top part of the page are 9 small photos of 9 separate nationwide scattered meetings of lodges, all showing the 6 people in attendance at that particular meeting. The photos are Arcadian Lodge number 2696 in London, Carfax Lodge number 5723, that's Oxfordshire, White Star Chamber number 8727, that's in Hertfordshire, Cambridgeshire Annual Provincial Meeting, St John's Lodge number 8817, that's Bedfordshire, Skiddaw Lodge number 1002, that's Cumberland and Westmorland, Provincial Grand Lodge of Bedfordshire, Rose of England Lodge number 8493, that's in Sussex, and United Services Lodge number 1428 for Hampshire and the Isle of Wight. Page 17 starts the stories section, people, places, history and more. And the four stories we have this time are Taking the Grand Tour, a warm welcome from Open House London at Freemasons Hall, Quickfire Questions, David Wheeler, the Provincial Grand Master and Grand Superintendent for Lincolnshire, The Freemason with High Hopes, this is remembering Bob Smith's record Skydive for Charity, and Talking Freemasonry in conversation with the team behind Podcast Brother.
On page 18... Open Door Policy. The rousing shrill of the bagpipes heralded this year's Open House event at Freemasons Hall, and restrictions aside, visitors enjoyed a warm Masonic welcome. Like everything in 2020, this year's Open House London weekend was always going to be different. This is the annual event when thousands of buildings across the capital open their doors to offer the public free behind-the-scenes tours. COVID restrictions made sure 2020's version would be uniquely challenging, but Freemasons Hall still attracted more than 1,300 visitors when it opened for the weekend of September 19th and 20th. Attendees took self-guided tours of the Grand Temple, talked to Masonic volunteers, and watched a World War I reenactment society who set up camp in the vestibule and played bagpipes outside Freemasons Hall every hour to attract passers-by. It was a big decision to go ahead, but it felt very important that we do so, says Michelle Warville, UGLE Director of Communications and Marketing. This is one of our best opportunities each year to open the building and talk to the public about Freemasonry, which is hugely important to us at the moment as an organisation. Last year was the first time we opened on both days of the weekend, and we were the second most popular building in London after the Foreign Office. We wanted to build on that success. We also did a lot digitally, so people who didn't want to attend physically could watch a video that provided a behind-the-scenes tour. We were determined to provide a great experience, but in a safe, COVID-compliant way, and getting digital footfall where we couldn't get a physical one. The first step was to ensure the building was COVID-secure. A one-way system was introduced. There was a temperature check at the door. Numerous hand sanitising stations were installed, and members of the public and volunteers were asked to wear masks and socially distance at all times. These protocols were followed by the public without complaint. The next stage was to let people know the building was open. Banners were hung outside, while the UGLE, Freemasons Hall and the Open House Umbrella Organisation promoted the event on social media. Around 28% of visitors saw the banners during the week before and came to see what was happening, says Nicole Ladner, the event's executive. We attracted more people through the UGLE website and social media, but a lot of them heard the bagpipes and came to see what was going on. You would see them coming over from Covent Garden when they heard the noise. Once inside the building, visitors went up to the vestibule, where the World War I Reenactment Society was based. This was to mark the connection between World War I and Freemasons Hall, which was built as a memorial to fallen Freemasons. The reenactors really made the event, says Nicola. They set up a World War I camp with a nursing station and a vintage motorcycle, and they carried out a gas drill as well as demonstrations and a talk about their uniform and equipment. They usually do cavalry displays, but we didn't quite have the space for that. Just as important in setting the tone were the Masonic volunteers. Many had taken part the previous year, relishing a rare opportunity to meet the public and talk about Freemasonry. Even with COVID, Michelle and Nicola were getting so many volunteers they had to turn people down. Ultimately, around 35 volunteers were on hand to talk to visitors and help them navigate the building. They loved having the chance to meet the public, says Nicola. It is so important to help people understand what Freemasonry is about and how proud they are of being Freemasons. The volunteers had a very good time, and that meant a lot to us as we wanted them to feel comfortable and to enjoy themselves. As well as the volunteers and the World War I reenactors, leading Masonic organizations, including the MCF, the Freemasons charity, and the Order of Women Freemasons, set up stalls with literature available describing what they do. The Teddies for Loving Care charity was also present and gave a free teddy to any child who purchased a mask. Adult masks were available as well. Children were also presented with a colouring book and could take part in a treasure hunt. They were given individually sealed packs of bright bricks to take home so they could construct their own model of Freemasons' Hall. The Museum of Freemasonry was open, while organists played regular recitals on the restored organ in the Grand Temple. Milling around were the genial hosts of Brother, the Masonic podcast, who were interviewing visitors and volunteers for a future show. Videos were placed online for the duration of the open house weekend, featuring recitals and a behind-the-scenes tour hosted by the museum curator. These were accessed by more than 4,000 people over the course of the weekend. Given the situation, the organisers knew they would not match last year's record attendance, but were still delighted by the eventual turnout. This was split evenly over both days of the event and was at the higher end of their estimates. It went so well, says Nicola. Considering the circumstances, attendance was really good, and we got great feedback on the visitor survey. We know we can just pick it up next year without having had any interruption and make it even bigger and better. We can trial new things and include all the bits that really worked. It sounds as if we can expect more bagpipes outside Freemasons Hall in 2021.
The second story in this section is A Brush with the Law. Meet Dave Wheeler, Provincial Grand Master and Grand Superintendent for Lincolnshire, former Chief Superintendent, Police Negotiator and avid Lincoln City FC supporter. As a teenager, Dave Wheeler loved the sporting opportunities that Lincoln Grammar School provided, and that was part of the reason he joined Lincolnshire Police as a cadet in 1976. The police cadets offered not only an interesting job, but the chance to get involved in a lot of physical and sporting activities, he said. Having completed more than 30 years police service, Dave retired as a chief superintendent in 2008. For 12 years, one of my roles was as a police negotiator. It was testing work, dealing with people in immediate crisis situations, but very rewarding too. As a result of this work, Dave was a regular presenter on the National Siege Management course at the UK Police Staff College. He also presented case studies in the UK and the USA. On retirement, Dave was the county commander for Lincolnshire St John's Ambulance for 4 years, overseeing more than 600 volunteers. In 2009 and again in 2012, he visited Nepal, where he presented two ambulances donated by SJA, that's the St John's Ambulance, to villagers in the Lumbini region. Until 2017, Dave was a self-employed consultant and performance development coach, working with individuals to improve their performance, as well as writing and delivering major incident planning exercises for local authorities. In his spare time, Dave is a committed follower of Lincoln City Football Club, where he's been a season ticket holder for many years.
What first appealed about Freemasonry?
My father and older brother were Freemasons, so I think it was the sense of joining an extended family. The sense of calm within the lodge and the formality with fun at the festive board made the greatest initial impression on me.
Has Freemasonry improved your life?
In my early days, it was a complete distraction from a hectic day-to-day life. Attending a lodge was, to me, an oasis of calm. Learning and delivering ritual with tremendous mutual support from others gave me a lot of confidence in delivering presentations and public speaking.
What was the most memorable part of your initiation?
seeing colleagues and friends, some of whom I had no idea were Freemasons, and also the structure and enjoyment of the festive board made a huge impression.
What values do you most admire?
Integrity. If people make mistakes but are acting with the right intentions, then we can learn and move forward. If someone deliberately sets out to make mischief or mislead, then I find it hard to understand their intentions.
Famous Freemason you admire?
As a role model, the Grand Master has to be the best example I can think of who gives service before self. To hold that position for more than 50 years and still be actively involved is incredible.
Best bit of advice you've ever received?
To treat people as you would like to be treated and be true to yourself. It has served me well through my career in the police and in my journey as a Freemason.
Which book made an impact on you?
As a teenager, I was given a copy of The Lord of the Rings by my sister. I couldn't put it down then, and I still return to it now. I like reading for recreation and to be taken to other places within my imagination. I also enjoy science fiction, and the Dune series by Frank Herbert is another example of a completely absorbing and alternative universe.
Favourite place in the world and why?
I've been lucky to have been able to travel a lot in these last few years, and I love visiting North America. The Grand Canyon, Yosemite and Yellowstone were all on my bucket list and all exceeded my expectations. Australia and New Zealand are still on my to-do list.
Are you a music fan?
My music tastes are completely random, but I am a big fan of Queen, ELO and 10cc. I didn't manage to see Queen perform, but I have seen Brian May, Jeff Lynne's ELO and 10cc live over the past few years, and they've all been brilliant. My children would say that I also like Eurovision, but I couldn't possibly comment.
On page 24, Free Falling Mason. In memory of Lincolnshire's Bob Smith, who sadly passed away recently, we pay our respects to him and his achievement of being the oldest Freemason to have made a charity tandem jump. Committed Freemason Bob Smith has passed away only weeks after leaping into the record books as the oldest Freemason ever to have made a tandem parachute jump for charity. Bob, 85, died at home in Horncastle on the 27th of October with his daughter Alison beside him. His incredible feat had come after a tough year for Bob. He lost his wife Pam in March, and on top of all his other illnesses, he had been diagnosed with lung cancer. But he refused to let that stop him from going through with his parachuting ambition to raise funds for the hashtag Lynx2025 festival. Bob shared his thoughts on the jump and a week of surprises, which we include here. "I came up with the idea, and they said I was mad," said Bob, about how the jump had grown out of a conversation between friends who were discussing how to make a positive contribution to the fund. Just after his 85th birthday, Bob plunged in freefall before his instructor at Skydive Hibblestow opened the parachute for the rest of the descent, which took 15 minutes. "It was a fantastic experience," said Bob. "We took the scenic descent, and I could see the North Sea, the River Humber, and all the local villages laid out beneath me. I didn't close my eyes once. I had a huge rush of adrenaline and a massive sense of achievement. Although I've done the jump, my feet haven't touched the ground since because of everything else that has happened." Everything else includes Bob being bestowed with the honour of the Knight of the Ancient Masonic Order of Alfred the Great by the Grand Master of the Order of Athelstan, Paul Weldon Johnston. He was also promoted to the rank of past provincial Grand Borough for his contribution to Freemasonry, especially in the Masonic Order of Athelstan and the Court of Herncaster No. 102. Bob enjoyed a surprise birthday party under the guise of a meeting to discuss urgent Masonic business, and Lincolnshire's PGM Dave Wheeler presented him with photos on behalf of the province as a memento. "What people have given is astonishing, and I'm really grateful," said Bob.
The last article in this stories section is called Broadcast News. The team behind Podcast Brother are putting a fun spin on discussing Freemasonry and reaching an audience beyond members. Peter Watts gets them together for a chat. And we start with Neil Thomas Allen. He says, "Hello and bonjour. I, together with my best friend Taz, Josh and Jack are Brother, the Masonic Podcast. We started it about 2.5 years ago when Taz and I realised there wasn't a regular episodic Masonic podcast in the UK. On one of our wine-fueled socials, we started to discuss what we could do if we had our own podcast. Taz Bachu comes in. "We were both busy at work and only saw each other at lodge meetings," he says. "We were chewing the fat after a meeting and discussed how we struggle to find time to see each other. That drove us to get the podcast up and running. It was an excuse to get together over a bottle of wine and talk about something we both really loved. The first ones were recorded in my office boardroom." Neil again. "In episode one, Taz encapsulated what Brother is all about. Friends in a room, talking about Freemasonry, gloves off. We loved that metaphor and wanted to bring Freemasonry to people at a lodge level. Our aim is to give them something to listen to so they can catch up with the world of Freemasonry, but at a fun, light-hearted level. After Taz and I did the first episode, we realised that we needed an extra pair of hands, and we began discussing the podcast with Josh, another of the younger Freemasons in our lodge." Josh Worley comes in and says, "Neil edited the first episodes himself and then approached me to edit the podcast as I had experience in radio. I was honoured to be asked. None of us had any idea what it would become." Neil again. "Josh has a fantastic broadcasting voice, so we instantly got him to read the news section." Josh. "I suppose that being from Norwich, it's the inherent Alan Partridge." Neil. "With Josh, we were able to do things more intelligently and started to structure the podcast. Each episode began with something non-Masonic to make people feel comfortable. One of us would choose a wine and we'd talk about that for 5 minutes or so." Taz says, "I would run to Borough Market to pick up wine while Neil and Josh were working on audio levels. I have a backlog of wine for season three." Neil, "We found the balance quite quickly. It's a light-hearted, optimistic take on Freemasonry that's heavy enough to cater for hardcore Freemasons without using too many insider terms to scare away non-Freemasons. We introduced a news section and we had guests from the UGLE and other orders like Mark Master Masons and Christine Chapman, Grand Master of the Honourable Fraternity of Women's Freemasons. That was one of my favourite episodes. We pride ourselves in being able to make people feel at home. When Josh moved back to Norwich, we then reached out to Jack." And here Jack Saunders comes in. He says, "I was a fan of the podcast. I listened to the American ones, and after hearing Brother, I knew I had to get involved somehow. I took it as a challenge to build the online presence, and we dabbled with the idea of video. When COVID happened, we had to move to Zoom anyway, and that turned out to be a really simple way for us to make the switch to video." Josh again. "Our move to Zoom happened just as we started Series 2. We were talking to senior Freemasons across the country, and it's been so much easier to ask people to jump on a Zoom call to talk about the craft with us." Taz again. "Jack helped us spring into the provinces a bit more. People assume we're all London Freemasons, but my mother lodge is Warwickshire. Josh is in Norwich, Jack is in Essex, and Neil is Kent. Zoom has let us broaden our scope and educated us of the art of the possible. At first it was about who can get to London Bridge on the day. Now we can talk to anyone in the country or even overseas." Josh again. "The world of Freemasonry is fascinating. There are so many really interesting and educational things to be discovered, and our audience is just as diverse as Freemasonry. We have listeners of all ages, shapes and sizes from all around the world." Neil. "We also have non-Freemason listeners. We hear from people who have a family connection to Freemasonry and feel we've given them an understanding of the craft." Jack. "We removed the shroud a little bit about Freemasonry. Some Freemasons aren't sure what they can and can't talk about, but we're comfortable with our Freemasonry and are experienced enough to know that you can discuss 99% of things. We hope that will encourage others to talk about Freemasonry." Taz, "We came to this podcast as experienced Freemasons, but we don't know everything. Over the past two seasons, our eyes have been opened to other orders." Jack says, "Our wallets have been opened as well." Josh says, yes, in terms of equipment, we started off in a basic way, but then I went and bought the best in the business podcasting kit. It was heartbreaking because we barely had a chance to use it before COVID happened. Having this new kit is one of the reasons we can't wait to start recording season 3 together. Taz says, season 3 will be like meeting an old friend again. Wherever possible, we'll be recording in person. We'll have a more worldly view as we want to connect with more people all over the globe, and we want to keep getting major guests from the world of Freemasonry. Neil, when we started, we were nervous we might upset some of the senior Freemasons. Taz says, there were definitely moments when we had to stop and think. Did we just say that? Josh says, there was one episode where we raised an eyebrow about an issue and were nervous how that would be received. But it was taken very well, and our relationship with UGLE has got stronger. We believe we are here for grassroots Freemasons, but we don't want to be difficult for the sake of it. Neil says, it's been a delight to work with UGLE and the other orders. At the moment, everyone needs to pull together to raise people's spirits. One of our core principles is brotherly love, and this podcast is a culmination of that. We've had guests from UGLE who might have been dubious initially, but realised in 30 seconds that we were going to make them feel welcome and that we just love Freemasonry. Jack says, UGLE has a new communication strategy that has changed the outlook of the organisation, being much more open, and we have a similar outlook. Taz finally says, thank you to all the people who have listened and taken the podcast to their hearts. And you can listen to Brother Podcast at www.brothermasonic.com or twitter.com/brothermasonic. Now we come to the next section, A Daily Advancement, Extending Knowledge of Freemasonry. And there are three articles. The first one, Ancients and Moderns, is Dr. Rick Berman writes on the Union of 1813. And then on the side, the Ancient and Masonic Order of the Scarlet Cord, we look at that. And then finally, Spreading the Word, the Museum of Freemasonry, on the importance of Masonic periodicals.
On page 32, Ancients versus Moderns. There is confusion over what is meant by ancients, or ancients, as compared with moderns Freemasonry. The answer is simple, but in some ways counterintuitive, explains Dr. Rick Berman. The First Grand Lodge of England, formed in 1717, reigned supreme until 1751, when a rival institution was established, backed predominantly by London Irish Freemasons. This was the Grand Lodge of England according to the old institutions, known colloquially and ever since as the Ancients Grand Lodge. Lawrence Dermot, an Irishman, became Grand Secretary of the Ancients the following year, and it was Dermot who popularised the term moderns to denigrate and deride his Masonic counterparts as a means of differentiating Ancients Freemasonry. Dermot stated that the Ancients Grand Lodge was the custodian of a more traditional and thus more legitimate Masonic ritual, positioning Ancients Freemasonry as part of a long, well-established tradition of keeping the ancient landmarks in view. It was in this context that he identified the Ancients Grand Lodge with York Freemasonry and termed the rival Grand Lodge of England as moderns. The description was, and was intended to be, pejorative. At a time when institutional age had powerful implications for legitimacy, it was a clever move. In fact, a similar tactic had been employed by the First Grand Lodge of England itself some 3 decades earlier, when James Anderson described Adam as our first parent and dated Freemasonry to Noah and time immemorial. Dermot went further, satirising moderns Freemasonry and the moderns Grand Lodge, and amusing and flattering prospective members to entice them to join. It was an effective exercise in organisational self-promotion, and the moderns were for some decades unable to compete. From a modest base of 5 lodges in June 1751, the Ancients grew rapidly, and 4 years on, there were over 1,000 members across more than 40 lodges. In 1758, a union was established with the Grand Lodge of Ireland to the exclusion of the moderns, the original Grand Lodge of England. The pact was made tripartite in 1773 when Scotland joined, and the third Duke of Atholl was both Grand Master of the Ancients and Grand Master Elect of the Grand Lodge of Scotland, a pattern repeated subsequently. By the mid-1770s, Ancients membership exceeded 5,000. A decade later, there were more than 200 affiliated lodges, around 75 in London, more than 80 in the provinces, and over 45 overseas. And this excludes lodges warranted by daughter lodges, not least the Grand Lodge of Pennsylvania. But the growth and development of Ancients Freemasonry was not sustained by public relations alone. There were other factors. Did this include the supposed major differences in ritual that were at the time put forward as the ostensible reason for the schism between moderns and ancients? They may have done, but they were relatively trivial, and this was known at the time. Hiram, or the Grand Master Key, published in London 1766, compared the two rituals and showed that there were no material contradictions. The passwords and grips in the degree ceremonies were sometimes transposed, a switch made by the moderns to exclude those whose knowledge had been gleaned from press exposures. But such a ruse would have become known rapidly. Other differences included changes in the way initiates were prepared, a failure to recite the old charges in full, not using a sword during the initiation, and the differing roles of stewards and deacons. But the most significant was that the moderns did not allow additional degrees to be worked in the lodge, whereas the ancients came to champion the royal arch and other degrees. Since Masonic ritual varied not only regionally, but also from lodge to lodge, and such differences, minor or major, were the rule rather than the exception, stressing differences in ritual masked something else. What about the different constitutions used by the moderns and ancients? Again, with the exception of the introduction, Dermot's Ahiman Reason, first published in 1756, was based almost entirely on Edward Spratt's Constitutions for the Uses of Lodges in Ireland, published in Dublin in 1751, which was itself lifted almost word for word from Anderson's Moderns Constitutions. So what was really the cause of the antipathy between the ancients and moderns that lasted throughout the second half of the 18th century? The main reason was a blend of social and financial factors. Unlike its more elite moderns counterpart, the principal purpose of Ancients Freemasonry was to provide an accessible social infrastructure for its predominantly lower middling membership and a framework for mutually funded welfare payments. Within Ancients Freemasonry, charitable contributions were obligatory, not voluntary, and there was an established structure for arranging relief to members and their families. And Ancients Freemasonry assisted in other ways, including granting membership certificates, which provided a passport to lodges elsewhere in Britain and overseas. This presented members with a potentially beneficial network of social support and work opportunities. The way Ancients lodges functioned and their embrace of a wider social catchment was viewed with loathing by certain members of the moderns. In addition, there was a chronic prejudice against the London Irish. Both are seen clearly in A Defence of Freemasonry, published in 1759, and almost certainly written by the moderns' Grand Secretary Samuel Spencer, who was known for his anti-Ancients views. The pamphlet demonstrates his prejudice against the lower middling and the Irish in particular. Spencer disdainfully describes an Ancients lodge meeting that includes a three-hour lecture by a red-hot Hibernian, followed by the initiation of a sedan chairman who, too poor to pay his lodge fee in full, offers 5 shillings plus an IOU. Spencer's contempt is obvious. They are a disgrace to society, some with scarcely a coat or shirt to their backs. The Union of 1813 united ancients and moderns, but the why and how are another story.
Page 34 has an article entitled An Ancient Order for the 21st Century. In 1889, the Royal Order of the Knights of the Scarlet Cord came to prominence. Dan Heath looks at what happened to the original order and how the present incarnation compares. On the 25th of July 2010, the Ancient and Masonic Order of the Scarlet Cord was inaugurated at a splendid ceremony held in the Grand Temple of Freemasons Hall, Great Queen Street. It had originally been known as the Royal Order of the Knights of the Scarlet Cord in the late 19th and early 20th century. So what changed? To start at the beginning, we have to delve even further back into history to documents unearthed in the archives of Amsterdam Freemasonry, dating to the early 18th century. You may recall from the article on the Order of the Secret Monitor in issue 51 of FMT that that order also has origins in the Netherlands. The Orders of the Secret Monitor and Scarlet Cord are inextricably linked to this day. His Honour Judge Frederick Adolphus Philbrick KC is the man credited with masterminding the 1889 order, and many of its cohorts in the master plan are names familiar to those who enjoy Masonic research. Dr. Issachar Zachary, founder and primus grand supreme ruler of the Order of the Secret Monitor, Colonel Shadwell Clark, grand secretary of the craft, and Charles Fitzgerald Matier, grand secretary of the mark, to name a few, plus representatives from around the world, chiefly India, South Africa, and Myanmar. The order was established to recognise those who had given considerable amounts to the OSM Fund of Benevolence and to encourage them to continue to do so. Comprising 6 degrees, or grades as they were called in this order, there were also 3 wings or funds concentrating on old age, sickness and education, plus 9 steps of membership. Progression to each came at the price of a further donation to the OSM Benevolent Fund. The original order was rather complex, and to fully understand its structure would take more than these pages allow. However, with the intervention of World War I, the order went into abeyance, and despite a revival in 1919, in 1929 it fell into disuse when a resolution was passed that all ceremonial work in connection with the Royal Order of the Knights of the Scarlet Cord should cease. In June 2001, Peter Glyn Williams, most worthy Grand Supreme Ruler of the OSM, delivered an address to Supreme Rulers Conclave No. 123 at Mark Mason's Hall, outlining the history of the original order. The research for this address provided the foundation for his vision of bringing the order back into mainstream Freemasonry. Committees and subcommittees were formed. Rituals were developed. Scarlet Cord conclaves were established within the Order of the Secret Monitor in which to work the grades, so that by the time of the 2010 inauguration of the Scarlet Cord, as an independent sovereign order, there were 64 Scarlet Cord conclaves and more than 2,500 members. Michael Guest was elected to be the first Grand Sumu, that's Grand Master, with Brian Wareham as his deputy and Andrew Sweeney as his assistant. Today, the order comprises 133 consistories, no longer called conclaves, working in 22 provinces and 5 districts overseas, from Hong Kong and Southeast Asia through India, up into the Mediterranean, Western Europe and Scandinavia, and then across to the Caribbean islands. Due to the passage of time, it's rare to find a Masonic ruler who was responsible for writing much of the ceremonial ritual of this order, but the present Grand Summus, most distinguished companion, Ian Stanley Currens, recalls penning the first draft of the address to the newly installed president of a consistory, Master, somewhere over the Atlantic Ocean on a flight he was taking from Washington to London. Sticking to the concept of the original order, it still comprises 6 grades. First grade, Ostiari, or doorkeeper. This grade tells the story of how, in Jericho, Rahab assisted the escape of Israelitish spies, and is during this ceremony that the candidate is invested with the Scarlet Cord, the significance of which is detailed in the ritual. Rahab's good deed ensured the safety of her family during the sacking of Jericho by Joshua, and she would go on to give birth to Boaz. Second grade, lectores, or reader. Here the focus is on the biblical story Naomi and Ruth, wife of Boaz. Third grade, fellow or healer and exorcist. The candidate in this ceremony represents a knight, educated and of noble birth, and is required to consider his response should he face difficulty, danger or peril in any just cause. It also has echoes with the ceremony of raising in the craft and the story of the Holy Royal Arch. Fourth grade, Counselor. This is the first of three grades conferred by Grand Senatus. It is dramatic, colourful and musical and tells the story of the Ark of the Covenant crossing the River Jordan and the fall of the walls of Jericho. Fifth grade, Keeper of the Hidden Secret. The events portrayed in this ceremony represent a significant episode in the Masonic tradition of King Solomon's Temple, as well as impressing on the mind lessons of faith, ministry and perseverance. And the sixth grade is Prince of Jerusalem. This is the climax of the order, and it's conferred on recipients only at the discretion of the Grand Summus himself. Set in the 2nd century BC, the struggles and ultimate triumph of the Jewish people to throw off the yoke of oppression and persecution are related. In addition to these grade ceremonies, there is also the preparation ceremony, essential before one may be installed as president of a consistory. It is unique in Freemasonry, as in order to be elected to take the chair, the recipient is required to answer questions relating to three grades of the order through which he has passed to prove his proficiency and understanding thereof. Once installed as a president, he will be reliant upon the assistance of the Primus of Lectores and Primus of Ostiari, equivalent to the senior and junior wardens or second and third principals, who have large parts to play when conferring grades within his consistory. Thus, the Order of the Scarlet Cord, open to all princes of the Order of the Secret Monitor, is a modern Masonic order for the 21st century, but with all the pageantry, splendour and ritualistic verve of its 19th century forebear. And there's a fact file alongside this article. First, who is in charge? The most distinguished Grand Summus, Ian Stanley Currens. He is assisted by the Right Distinguished Deputy Grand Summus, Francis Charles Spencer, and the Right Distinguished Assistant Grand Summus, Howard Saul Markham. Who can join? The order is open to princes of the Order of the Secret Monitor. As the OSM is unable to confer the prince's degree during COVID-19, a concordat between the orders allows members of the OSM to join the Scarlet Cord before they receive the prince's degree. Is there a lot of regalia? No. The first two grades require a jewel, lent to you by the consistory, suspended from a scarlet cord. The third requires a breast jewel, which changes with each grade thereafter. Provincial, stroke district, stroke grand officers wear a sash and collarette. Further information can be obtained from Beyond the Craft by Keith B. Jackson. It's available at the Mark Mason's Hall shop. The Grand Summus talks about the order at www.brothermasonic.com, and you can find out more at www.markmasonshall.org/orders/scarlet-cord.
On page 36, read all about it. The Museum of Freemasonry's periodical collection provides a fascinating snapshot into bygone years, says Marketing and Communications Manager Barry Hughes. We normally reserve these pages for a single object from the museum's collection. However, in keeping with these unusual times, we'd like to break from that tradition and ask you to consider a collection of items as a treasure, Masonic periodicals. The Museum of Freemasonry's library and archives are without doubt a detailed landscape of exploration for the Freemason and researcher alike. Indeed, for anyone with a keen interest in the 18th and 19th centuries, they are an invaluable resource. The library is packed with unusual lines of research, from social documentary to biblical lineages and everything in between. If there is one thing that ties so much of these lines of inquiry together, it is the humble periodical. Bounding from 17th century continental Europe to a very British boom in the 18th century, it's a wonderful invention of mass communication. It is no surprise that what seemed to fuel the boom in magazines and periodicals was largely a love and addiction to coffee and conversation. In Britain, while the mechanisms of empire rolled on, it created a city culture at home, most notably in London and Edinburgh, where the coffee house and tavern played a vital part. The recanting of mercantile tales, gossip from Parliament, and the arguments of earnest artists ensured that fashions flourished and entrepreneurs never sat still. Key figures such as Sir Richard Steele regularly hogged the limelight, as he either established or had a hand in establishing many titles including Tatler, The Spectator, and The Guardian. While these titles appear familiar today, they are by no means the same publications as their 18th century namesakes. There is often the question as to whether Steele was a Freemason. The only known association is a curious engraving first published in Bernard Picard's Cérémonies et Coutumes religieuses de tous les peuples du monde, circa 1735. The chart lists all 130 English lodges in existence at the time, and at centre above all the listings is a titled portrait of Sir Richard Steele. But there appears to be no reason given for this, nor any actual documentary evidence of Steele joining or attending any lodge. Nevertheless, while these popular periodicals were being produced, it was clear that a title aimed specifically at men and another at women was a successful entrepreneurial move. The gender divide was not exclusive, however, as some periodicals had their own political ties and agendas, while others were more concerned with activities such as literary review. So it is no surprise that titles produced solely for Freemasons soon emerged. The Freemasons magazine launched in 1793 and ran for 6 years, while the Masonic Illustrated produced 72 issues from 1900 until closing in 1906. Periodicals are inherently temporary, so their continued physical existence is a challenge. Few complete series of these Masonic periodicals have survived in libraries, and they have only limited indexes. At the Library and Archives of the Museum of Freemasonry, we can help save and promote the wonderful examples that survive in our care today by digitizing them for online access. We worked with King's Digital Lab, King's College London, in creating a standalone website called Masonic Periodicals Online. It is a fantastic free resource that enables the most significant Masonic periodicals from 1790 to 1900 to be searched by keyword or phrase. This can be useful when researching a lodge or individual, but also a place such as Battle Abbey, for instance. The website gives you the opportunity to go right back to the world at that time, not with a view of nostalgia, but as it was unfolding. The articles, obituaries, news and reviews, and even the advertisements are a real snapshot of each respective era before the Great Wars cast a shadow over the 20th century. Of course, there is a symmetry to all of this, as you are currently reading a periodical that will eventually sit with these past examples for future generations to discover. Find out more at masonicperiodicals.org.
Now we reach the Grand Lodge section. This is news from Great Queen Street. And the articles in this section are Light in the Darkness, see Freemasons Hall lit up in remembrance of fallen comrades, Learning Online, the L&D team hosts the first virtual annual Solomon Conference, in Quarterly Communications, Programme Master Peter Lowndes on the many changes afoot, Members Pathway is welcoming a new team for a new stage and a more vibrant future, and Adapting to Lockdowns, the Museum of Freemasonry on keeping you safe. So the first article in this section is entitled For the Fallen, and it starts on page 40. In honour of those who shall not grow old, Freemasons Hall was lit up with a stunning and poignant projection of poppies on Remembrance Day. Marking three major anniversaries for Remembrance Day in November, the United Grand Lodge of England, UGLE, lit up Freemasons Hall in London with the names of those Freemasons who died in World War I to commemorate the 75th anniversary of VE and VI Day and the centenary of the unveiling of the Cenotaph in London. The projection was on display until 9 p.m. on the evening of Armistice Day and was shared widely on social media. In addition, more than 500 poppies donated by Staffordshire Freemasons were on display in the vestibules inside the stunning Grade 2 listed building, which was built as a peace memorial after World War II. The names of the 3,000 Freemasons are immortalised on the Roll of Honour within the hall. Freemasons have always had a strong relationship with the armed services, and UGLE has worked with Remembrance Penny, who donated a bronze poppy in a case inscribed with the words "They shall not grow old" for those Freemasons who died for their country. Funds raised from the sale of the pennies will go to support combat stress to help continue delivering life-changing specialist services to veterans across the UK. The poppy will be permanently situated in the vestibules as a symbol of reflection and contemplation for those servicemen and women who have served their country. At 11 a.m. on the 11th of November, UGLE live streamed on its Facebook channel the 2-minute silence in front of the Peace Memorial at Freemasons Hall, with a bugler playing the last post in tribute to those who died. Dr. David Staples, UGLE's chief executive, said the history of Freemasons Hall is directly linked to the Great War. There were more than 3,000 Freemasons killed in action during World War I, and in honour of those members, Freemasons Hall was rebuilt as a peace memorial to all Freemasons who gave their lives for their country. This year, even in a difficult period, we've found a way to remember their ultimate sacrifice. To find out more about the role Freemasons played during periods of national war, members of the public can view the online Brothers in Arms website, that's ALMS Arms, at www.brothersinarms, that's Brothers in and then ALMS, all one word, .co.uk. This exhibition of rare photographs spans the period from the Second Boer War through to the end of World War II and features those who led and those who served on land, sea and in the air. It portrays the great landscape of the conflict across all continents and the diversity of the participants.
On page 42, Learning in Lockdown. Due to the difficulties involved with meeting in real life, the Learning and Development team has hosted the first virtual annual Solomon Conference. Since its successful launch more than 2 years ago, Solomon has evolved and will keep doing so in a style that ensures its content is produced in the most beneficial way to our members. In July, Solomon launched Share and Encourage, Mentors Corner, a module that has been providing lodges and chapters with material for online gatherings and methods to best present that material. The decision was made in mid-2020 to hold a virtual learning and development conference as opposed to a physical one. With the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, not only was this safer for everyone, but it allowed for more inclusion by facilitating attendance by those who might be restricted by distance or other constraints. The Learning and Development team hosted the conference from within Solomon itself using Big Blue Button, an integral conferencing tool that has been used to great success previously to provide webinars to new users. This was the ideal platform to hold the conference itself, not only for the communication and breakout facilities, but also as a repository for all of the documents the attendees would require. Spread across 2 days, the conference aimed at establishing better contact and interactive relationships with learning and development leads, and was attended by more than 80 delegates from across the provinces and districts as far as the District of Madras, and representing both craft and the Royal Arch. They shared ideas and discussed existing learning and development strategies within their own provinces and districts, as well as how they planned to move forward using Solomon and other learning and development initiatives. The conference featured keynote talks by both the Deputy Grand Master, Right Worshipful Brother Jonathan Spence, and the Third Grand Principal, Most Excellent Companion Gareth Jones, OBE. While acknowledging that one size does not fit all, and recognising the importance of varied interpretation, both referred to the critical role that Solomon has to play as part of an integrated response to re-engage with our intellectual underpinning and its increasingly important role in retaining members by ensuring that our values are understood. Full versions are available on Solomon. Case studies were presented from the provinces of Staffordshire, practical aspects of implementing a Solomon strategy, Shropshire, the Chiseller's Lodge of Instruction, Monmouthshire, Introduction to Solomon, a provincial workshop, and Yorkshire West Riding, Masonic Light Webinars, by the Learning and Development Leads, focusing on the core ideas of increasing effectiveness within metropolitan areas, provinces and districts, and fostering curiosity within lodges. These outlined the ways in which the respective provinces were using the material on Solomon to their greatest benefit, and the successes that they had achieved within their provinces. The learning and development team was also joined by the President of the Board of General Purposes, Right Worshipful Brother Geoffrey Deering, and the Grand Secretary, Very Worshipful Brother Dr. David Staples, for a live Q&A and discussion forum, during which the role of the Learning and Development Programme was contextualised as part of the integrated future. Dr. Craig Johnson's presentation on forthcoming features outlined some of the future engagement directed at those using Solomon, including the immediate launch of the Solomon User Group. A module will enable our users to get a first glimpse of some new material and provide feedback. In his closing comments, the chairman of the Learning and Development Group, Right Worshipful Brother Anthony Howlett Bolton, OBE, emphasized the importance of using this conference as a catalyst for stimulating future engagement within lodges, chapters, provinces, districts, and between the Learning and Development Leads and the Learning and Development Group. Ironically, in this time of uncertainty with disruption of normal meeting patterns, there has never been a better time to engage with our members. He also stressed the important role Solomon has to play in ensuring that modern Freemasonry is an attractive, must-join, relevant institution for modern men. Since the conference, more provinces and districts have hosted presentations using the ideas discussed at the conference and the resources on Solomon. Every month we will continue to add new and exciting content for provincial and district presentation teams to use themselves or pass along to lodges and chapters to present in their own online gatherings, or use as a springboard to produce their own content. The conference represents the culmination of months of hard work. However, it is only the beginning of expanding our core message of fostering curiosity, developing understanding, and supporting all of the learning and development leads across provinces and districts to help them bring as many resources as possible to our members, wherever they may be.
The next article is called The Winds of Change. In a message dated the 9th of September 2020, Pro Grand Master Peter Lowndes discusses the many changes afoot, both globally and in the world of Freemasonry. There are points in history when things change, times when the status quo jolts forward, whether we like it or not, and after such events, things never quite seem the same again because they change us as individuals and the way we look at the world. It was never quite as it was. In our more than 300-year history, Freemasonry will have experienced a number of such events. But since World War II, it's difficult to think of one that has had such a profound effect on society, on the economy and on us all, by what I am told is a little bundle of fat and protein hundreds of times smaller than the width of a human hair. In our response to it, and in the decisions we have taken, UGLE has followed two guiding principles. One, obey the law of the land and follow any official guidance issued. Two, trust our members and our lodges to decide what is right for them, facilitating and encouraging those that wish to meet, while supporting, understanding and respecting those who feel that the time is not yet right for them. There are also changes of which we had noticed that, by comparison, seem almost mundane, yet just a year ago were the subject of quite some debate. The decision to lower the age of initiations to 18 without dispensation brings Freemasonry into line with the age of majority adopted by the UK Parliament in 1969. The creation of provincial and lodge membership officers, as recommended by the Membership Working Party of the Board, will introduce a new collared office with a new responsibility to the craft, while changing the rules around unattached Freemasons and visiting will, we hope, make it easier for members to understand the character of a lodge. These changes have been widely consulted and widely approved, but as with all things, they will not please everyone. I'm sure you know the joke about how many Freemasons it takes to change a light bulb. While respecting our traditions, UGLE does not and never has moved at the speed of the slowest ship in the convoy, and we have shown perhaps over the past few months that we are not quite the oil tanker that some people took us for. During lockdown, we've received some unusually good publicity for the immense amount of wonderful voluntary work carried out worldwide. The excellent byproduct of this is a larger than usual number of potential initiates waiting in the wings. However, lodges were unable to make any progress due to the necessary social distancing rules and were in danger of stagnating as a result. It was for this reason that we asked a zealous and expert member and the ritual committee of the Emulation Lodge of Improvement to look at ways that we could temporarily vary the ritual to enable lodges to at least initiate and pass candidates. We never expected anyone to agree with all the suggestions, but we are confident that the changes will allow Freemasonry to bring in new blood to the benefit of all concerned. Surely this is what matters, not the dotting of the I's and the crossing of the T's as far as the ritual changes are concerned. We want lodges, and therefore chapters, to come alive again for the enjoyment and benefit of all concerned. Brethren, I feel it only right that in these closing remarks I pay tribute to those who have quietly and steadfastly done their bit. There are far too many to mention, you will know who you are. Up and down the country, across the world in our districts and here in Freemasons Hall in London, members, staff and volunteers have given of themselves in ways that they might never have imagined less than half a year ago, quietly doing what they can to make things better. The organisation has responded magnificently to the needs of the public and to those of our friends and neighbours. As we continue to navigate uncharted waters, I take comfort in the simplicity of the messages our rituals convey and exhort you ever to act in accordance with them in the weeks and months ahead. Respect each other and all humanity. Improve yourself and make your life and actions count.
On page 45, a new team for the next stage. As COVID-19 impacted our life and Masonic routines, 2020 has challenged us to work differently, but the work of the members' pathway has forged ahead. Daily advancements are key for every Freemason, and, while faced with the difficulties this pandemic has created, work has continued on the members' pathway, which seeks to assist lodges to attract new and retain the active involvement of existing members. The rollout of the members' pathway to lodges started in 2017/18 and was coordinated by each province. Lodges that have adopted the principles included in the 11 steps of the members' pathway have, in many cases, found new ways to attract more candidates, maintained the interest of existing members, and reconnected with those members who had resigned and were unattached. It has also helped to reinforce the opportunity to complete the journey to the Holy Royal Arch. This has undoubtedly helped to strengthen many lodges and ensure a more vibrant future. Data from the recently conducted provincial survey into the status of the pathway implementation has confirmed that it is viewed as a great concept, but that the take-up by many lodges in many provinces has been much slower than hoped. There were several extremely helpful suggestions coming out of the survey for the next stages of development. These included simplifying the documentation, developing more compelling marketing materials, and relaunching it. A new Members Pathway Working Party, PWP, has now been constituted, comprising one representative from each of the regional communications groups, RCG, into which the 47 provinces and Metropolitan Grand Lodge are grouped, with support from the UGLE Directors of Communications and Marketing and Membership Services. Each of the RCG representatives has hands-on experience with Pathway, typically as a provincial mentor or membership officer. The members of the PWP have a key role to play in the next stage of development of Pathway and ensuring that local lodge and regional needs are understood and met. They will also coordinate the implementation of Phase 2 of Pathway in each of their RCGs. To do this, they will be holding regular meetings with the provincial teams in their RCGs to ensure all involved are kept up to date with progress. The first of these meetings will be held shortly via video conference to brief everyone on the proposed plans. The overall aim? To make Pathway a concise, interactive, robust, and relevant blueprint for all lodges across UGLE to use post-COVID and build for the future. Some long-serving members on the previous working party have retired, and I would like to take this opportunity to thank them for their hard work and commitment.
Persevering with preservation. Before the November lockdown, the Museum of Freemasonry reopened for the curious. We now have measures put in place to keep future visitors safe. At 5 p.m. on the 15th of March 2020, we closed the doors to the museum, not knowing when we were likely to reopen. With the national lockdown announced within a week of the closure, the idea of reopening seemed even further away. Like everyone at the time, we followed the news and guidance being issued by the government as to when lockdown rules may be relaxed and when we could consider opening the doors of the museum to the public. In early July, the government announced that museums would soon be able to welcome visitors again. Working with our colleagues in Freemasons Hall, we decided that we would aim to reopen the building and the museum from the 1st of September. Weeks of intense planning followed as we sought advice, read constantly evolving government guidance, and researched best practice from around the world. Looking globally was really helpful. As other parts of the world were coming out from their own lockdowns at different times, we were able to see what was and wasn't working at other museums. As a result, our own ideas changed regularly. That stringent planning has enabled us to gain We're Good to Go accreditation from Visit Britain, the industry standard and consumer mark, confirming that we are following government and public health guidance on COVID-19. With the reopening date approaching and with so many changes put in place to keep everyone safe, it was important to retrain people and give them time to adjust to new ways of working. There was genuine excitement and some trepidation from staff as the reopening drew closer. However, 1st of September came and went without a hitch, and everyone was thrilled to see visitors back in the museum. People will notice some changes to how we operate. Entry to the museum remains free, lockdowns permitting, but if you want to visit, you will need to book a timed entry ticket in advance. This includes anyone who is visiting Freemasons Hall for a lodge meeting. This enables us to control the number of people in the museum and flow of visitors to enable social distancing. It also means we can capture contact details for NHS contact tracing purposes. Everyone who enters the building is required to have their temperature checked and use hand sanitizer. The temperature checks are contactless, and hand sanitizer is available at both the front desk and the museum welcome area. While within the museum, all visitors, unless exempt, need to wear a face covering. This is easy to forget if you've been in another part of Freemasons Hall that falls under different guidance and where you may not have been required to wear a face covering. Don't worry if you forget to bring one. We have masks available. Currently, we're showing the Three Centuries of English Freemasonry exhibition in the North Gallery and our Familiar Faces exhibition in the Museum Corridor. You'll find that we have a one-way system in operation through these areas, and we would ask all visitors to pay extra attention to any guidance issued by staff during their visit, as this will help keep everyone safe. The South Gallery remains closed for refurbishment, while access to the library and archives is for research purposes only at present. Those booking research slots, which must be booked at least 72 hours in advance, don't need to book separate museum entry tickets. While we all find ourselves adapting to a new way of living, there remains a strong drive in people for some level of normality and an ever-increasing thirst for cultural experiences. The Museum of Freemasonry is a treasure trove for exploration, and our dedicated team are excited to welcome you back and look forward to seeing you all again soon. You can book entry tickets or research slots at www.museumfreemasonry.org.uk. The Royal Arch section of the magazine begins on page 50, and it's thoughts from the Supreme Grand Chapter. Two articles. First, a spotlight on Stephen Tucker. He's the president of the Committee of General Purposes in Supreme Grand Chapter. And the other article is Compromise and Harmony, embracing the 200-year-old origins of the United Grand Lodge.
Beyond the Craft. Now into his second year as President of the Committee of General Purposes in Supreme Grand Chapter, Professor Stephen Tucker discusses the spirit of service and his quest to attract new members. When Stephen Tucker left the family farm in Somerset and arrived at Trinity College, Oxford in 1986, he knew his life was changing, but couldn't have anticipated the lasting impact the University of Oxford would have on both his professional and personal life. Within a year, he'd joined Apollo University Lodge No. 357, taking his first step on a rich and fulfilling Masonic journey that saw him become President of the Committee of General Purposes in Supreme Grand Chapter in 2019. He is also now a Professor of Biophysics at the University of Oxford, running a group that performs pioneering research into how cells work. "I am often asked why I got involved in Freemasonry so young," he says. "That is easy. I was intrigued by the organisation, but it was also simply what a lot of my friends were doing, and my proposer still remains a close friend and active Freemason. What is more interesting is why I still contribute so much time and energy to this organisation, and that's also a simple answer. I still believe wholeheartedly in the principles the organisation stands for and that it promotes among its members. I also believe in the spirit of public service and that you only get out of things what you put in." Over the past 34 years, Professor Tucker has certainly put a lot in. He first served in the chair of his mother lodge when he was just 22, too young, he admits, to entirely appreciate the honour, and has since gone on to perform the role at several other lodges. While still an undergraduate at Oxford, he began to join other orders and was fascinated by the Royal Arch, having been blown away by the beauty of the ceremony. He was then invited to join the Chapter of St. James, No. 2, in London, admiring their unusual ritual and vibrant membership. "The Royal Arch can be a profound and beautiful ceremony, as well as being fun and enjoyable," he says. "It has a rich history, and the ceremony of exaltation has a profound impact on everybody who goes through it. It is also an integral part of pure and ancient masonry, with origins that go back to the start of English Freemasonry." As his Masonic career progressed in tandem with his professional one, he began to take on greater Masonic responsibilities outside private lodges, starting in Oxfordshire, where he ended up as the Provincial Grand Director of Ceremonies in the Royal Arch. He eventually became a member of the Committee of General Purposes, and in 2019 was invited to take the role of President, replacing Malcolm Aish, the departing President, who had been in the role for 15 years. Malcolm gave Stephen some insight into what the role involved, but neither could have imagined what was to follow. "My principal role as president is to oversee the duties of the committee, which are similar to those of the Board of General Purposes in the craft," he says. "It's about ensuring the order runs smoothly and meets the needs of its members, but at all times within the framework of our regulations and our finances. My intention at first was not to change anything until I had learnt what was needed and developed a clearer picture. But the pandemic turned everything on its head. Fortunately, our organisation is resilient, and hopefully we will emerge stronger, if a little bruised around the edges. My objective is that when I leave this role, whenever that may be, I will have done my small part in making sure that we are good for another 200 years. In a time of stress and complication for the Masonic community, as well as the world at large, Stephen admits that his period in office so far has been challenging. But making things much easier is the close and supportive relationship between Supreme Grand Chapter and UGLE, both of which operate from Freemasons Hall. Several senior office holders have equivalent roles in both orders, and Stephen also has a seat on the Crafts Board of General Purposes to ensure the Royal Arch is represented in any decisions. As president of the committee, Stephen has overseen measures to ensure the Royal Arch can continue to operate during the pandemic, not just within its own rules, but also in response to changing local and national laws. He stresses that while some of these changes have been significant and a few controversial, they are all conceived as temporary measures designed to get the order through these difficult times. Once a greater degree of normality returns, Stephen hopes the Royal Arch will continue to attract new Master Masons into completing their Masonic journey. At the moment, around 40% of eligible craft Freemasons are also in the Royal Arch, and he wants that number to rise. People still wonder if it is the completion of your third degree or whether it is a fourth degree, but it is neither, says Stephen. It is the completion of your journey through pure and ancient masonry, and this becomes clearer when you begin to understand the history of the Royal Arch and the role it played in the union of the two Grand Lodges over 200 years ago. The close relationship between UGLE and the Royal Arch is therefore unique and not found anywhere else, not even in Scotland or Ireland. The more people understand about this relationship, the more they want to learn, and the more they enjoy it. He recommends Bernard E. Jones's Freemasons Book of the Royal Arch for those who wish to learn more. It says a lot about the appeal of the Royal Arch that Stephen maintains his enthusiasm and dedication while having a demanding full-time job as a professor of biophysics. I run a research group that studies how electrical signals move in and out of cells such as nerves, he says. These signals move as charged ions through small protein holes in the surface of the cell, and we are interested in how these holes open and close to act as electrical switches that control how our nerves and brain work. Unfortunately, these proteins can also go wrong in certain diseases, and so we want to understand why this happens and ask whether it can be fixed with new drugs. I have a full-time job running this research group, and there are only so many hours in the day. But I wouldn't be doing my role in the Royal Arch if I didn't thoroughly enjoy it and feel that I was contributing to a greater good. I have been a Freemason my entire adult life, and it has shaped me in so many positive ways that I feel honoured to be able to contribute back in whatever way I can.
The second article is entitled Stuck with the Sussex Fudge. Jim Daniel explores the implications of a compromise made more than 200 years ago that affects the Royal Arch today. Should we attempt to redefine it or continue to embrace it? What, if anything, might be done to improve the relationship between our craft degrees and the Royal Arch, the two constituent parts of pure ancient masonry? They are still stuck together by the Sussex fudge, so-called, the compromise wording agreed between the modern and ancient Grand Lodges in early 1813 to describe the relationship of the Royal Arch with their soon-to-be United Grand Lodge under the Duke of Sussex. The ancients regarded the Royal Arch as the culmination and essence of their craft, to the extent that the Royal Arch degree in effect consumed the fourth degree in their system. But the official attitude of the moderns to the Royal Arch degree was that it was an irregular and unrecognisable innovation in the body of Freemasonry. The committee appointed by the Duke of Sussex to resolve this problem had to define pure ancient masonry so that the Royal Arch was not excluded, for if it had been, the ancients would not have agreed to the union. According to Douglas Burford in his Batham Royal Arch Lecture in 1995, the final form of the eventual compromise, the Sussex Fudge, was not agreed until sometime between the 25th of November 1813, when the preliminary articles for the union were signed at Kensington Palace, and 27th of December 1813, when the final version was signed by the two Grand Masters. In Burford's view, there is a distinct possibility that when Article 2 was originally drafted, its first sentence read, "It is declared and pronounced that pure ancient masonry consists of 4 degrees and no more, viz. Those of the entered apprentice, the fellow craft, the master mason, and also the supreme degree of the Holy Royal Arch." However, in the final version, that first sentence was obviously altered to read, "It is declared and pronounced that pure ancient masonry consists of 3, i.e. not 4, degrees, and no more, viz. Those of the entered apprentice, the fellow craft, and the master mason, including the supreme order, i.e. not degree, of the Holy Royal Arch." It is this revised definition of the preliminary declaration that is still found in the current Book of Constitutions. Burford notes the calculated ambiguity of the definition and calls it a quite extraordinary equivocation. Others have also noted this anomaly. In Bernard Jones's Freemason's Book of the Royal Arch, 1957, he writes, "Such an anomalous condition could come only as a result of compromise arrived at after hard bargaining, a compromise possible only in the English way of thought, but it must be admitted that the compromise, illogical as it is, has worked. Outside the English jurisdiction, the Royal Arch is a separate degree." The fudge, as obvious as the definition of pure ancient masonry itself, is audacious and anomalous, written as it was a century after the formation of the Premier Grand Lodge in 1717. Under no other jurisdiction is the Royal Arch as closely connected with a craft Grand Lodge as it is under the English Constitution, where, as part of this indissoluble link, for example, rulers of the craft and many other senior officers occupy ex officio equivalent positions in Supreme Grand Chapter. Yet this ambiguous and anomalous definition has sufficed from 1818, when Supreme Grand Chapter was eventually formed, until today. However, by 1853, when it was belatedly included in the UGLE's Book of Constitutions, the second article of the preliminary declaration had already been stripped of its second sentence, which read, "But this article is not intended to prevent any lodge or chapter from holding a meeting in any of the degrees of the orders of chivalry according to the constitutions of such orders." That sentence was omitted because after the death of the Duke of Sussex in 1843, some of his fudge came unstuck. The degrees and orders beyond the craft, particularly the ancient and accepted rite, the Rosicroix, began to flourish, and UGLE felt its authority and status was undermined. Some 150 years later, pure ancient masonry faced another challenge. With membership numbers declining, an attempt was made in 2003 to clarify and thus strengthen the craft/RA relationship by adding another sentence to the definition of pure ancient masonry. But this was abandoned in 2009. In some provinces and districts, over 50% of the craft members are also in the Royal Arch, but many others fall below today's average of about 40% overlap in membership. What then about the future? We should all be concerned not just about finding new members in an ever-changing world, but also about their retention. I wonder whether, instead of worrying about the precise meaning of the Sussex fudge, we just accept it for what it is. A wonderfully British compromise that after 2 centuries now defines us and makes us unique. By embracing it, we might strengthen the connection between the Royal Arch and the craft without having to redefine or navigate around pure ancient masonry. For realistically, this is the only choice available to us. We cannot redefine the Royal Arch or cast it adrift as an independent order without also throwing out the very definition of pure ancient masonry by which our Grand Lodge has distinguished itself from the rest of the Masonic world and which we have maintained through thick and thin since 1813. to do so would so weaken the constitutional structure on which UGLE and Premier Grand Lodge is founded that even the basic principle that we've defined for regular Freemasonry may be questioned. But perhaps there is one institutional change that might also help. Would it not be an idea to return to an arrangement similar to that of the ancient lodges, where there is much closer union between the craft and Royal Arch? Perhaps even by allowing craft lodges somehow to join with their chapters to work the Royal Arch exaltation ceremony. Each lodge member would then see from the summons that on certain nights his lodge would be working the Royal Arch. He would see the order as an integral part of pure ancient masonry, and as the next natural step for him to take to complete his journey. The Articles of Union and the preliminary declaration in the Book of Constitutions would continue to be honoured. Work would be found for those occasions in lodge where there is no craft work to be done, and so on. This idea may prove to be unpopular or simply too difficult to enact, but one thing is certain, we are still stuck with the Sussex fudge, and, as my mother used to say, you can either like it or lump it. In the book review section, the four books this time are The Masonic Tutor's Handbooks, Volume 1 by Robert Lomas, and then Extremes of Fortune by Andrew White, followed by The Craft, How the Freemasons Made the Modern World by John Dickey, and finally The Hermetic Art of Memory by Alexander Dixon.
The first book review is for The Masonic Tutor's Handbooks, Volume 1, by Robert Lomas, and the reviewer is Andrew Pippin. Daily Advancement, Illumination for Apprentices. Have you ever proposed a new lodge member who has gone on to be initiated? For the more experienced among us, Robert Lomas's book may remind us of our responsibilities to new initiates. For the less experienced, this contains a wealth of information that can be passed to new members by their proposers. The author uses the term photon to describe the small yet essential details that can be shared with all new members. The book starts with a talk designed to reveal to new members the symbolic and abstract ideas introduced during their initiation. With that first ceremony being such an extraordinary and striking experience for many, a lot of the important details are often missed the first time around. Later in the book, Lomas deals with the seldom performed explanation of the first degree tracing board, showing that it is an essential item of lodge furniture very much worth studying by new initiates. Lastly, he sets out active strategies that new members should look to complete so that they can more effectively absorb the knowledge of the first degree before they move on to the second. At a casual first glance, this book might seem to be making a mountain out of a molehill. On further reflection, however, it makes very good sense. Masonic wisdom needs to be passed on well. There is also a digital resource for those Master Freemasons planning to deliver this information to new members. It can be accessed at openlodge.com. Lomas straightforwardly maps out the journey of knowledge that a newly made Freemason should ideally embark on to make a true daily advancement. Well worth a look by proposers and new members alike.
And The Masonic Tutor's Handbook Volume 1 is available from Lewis Masonic, 55 pages, price £7.50. The next book is Extremes of Fortune by Andrew White, A Life Worth Remembering, The Story of an Extraordinary Man, and it's reviewed by Sestrian. Martin Massey was born in 1898 into a comfortable financial security arising from the family firm, Mrs. Massey's Agency, established in 1845 by his great-grandmother. By the time of his birth, it had grown from modest origins in Derby to a headquarters in Baker Street, London, and commercial preeminence. This prosperity translated into a country house and a public school education at Oundle. Massey was launched into adulthood just as the Great War was hotting up. Commissioned into the Sherwood Foresters, his life might be thought conventional, But then came a decisive step towards one that involved extremes of fortune. Massey volunteered for the Royal Flying Corps, then in its infancy, with equipment all too often second best to the enemy's. Combat flying, after only a few hours' instruction, Massey's aircraft were mostly so poor they were called Fokker fodder. He fought with distinction, surviving attack, crashes and serious injury. Staying in the RAF, as it became, he served in Palestine and was a wing commander when global war came in 1939. He served with gallantry, surviving further serious injury and proving himself an excellent leader of men. Then came his own finest hour. He was captured and spent much of the war as senior British officer at Stalag Luft III, where the massive responsibility of deciding to approve the Great Escape fell on his shoulders. What does this all have to do with Freemasonry? You won't readily pick it up from this otherwise excellently researched and clear account in his life. It merits only three lines on page 61. But Air Commodore Massey, in addition to his CBE, his DSO and his MC, was an active Freemason from 1922 until his death in 1976. And Extremes of Fortune by Andrew White is published by Fighting High, 208 pages, price £19.95.
The third book review is for The Craft, How the Freemasons Made the Modern World, by John Dickey, and the reviewer is Richard Jaffa. A huge influence, Freemasonry around the world. If you want a global history of Freemasonry, it might require several chunky volumes, but John Dickey has produced an absorbing book which describes the origins of English and Scottish Freemasonry. Dickey shows how they have both largely avoided any contamination by politics, whereas in France, Italy, and the USA, they are often seen as being embedded in political life. As the subtitle of the book is meant to demonstrate, he aims to show how Freemasonry has been adopted in so many parts of the world, and also how the very concept and structure has been used by other respectable fraternal societies. Dickey also explores, however, the way Freemasonry was hijacked by grotesque criminal organizations, which nonetheless somehow professed to admire Freemasonry's teachings of loyalty and brotherly love. Although he rejects the many exposés and fabricated stories that have been created over three centuries, he is not blind to the errors of the past, especially the craft's needless tendency in previous times to be over-secretive. He analyzes the craft's relationship with the Catholic Church and how Freemasons influenced the Empire, and the role of Rudyard Kipling in promoting that. Dickey believes that these aspects of Freemasonry have helped forge the world as we know it. Being a professor of Italian at University College London, it is hardly surprising that he is especially strong on the terrible machinations of much of Italian Freemasonry and the scandal of P2. But he is no less lucid on the origins and development of Prince Hall Freemasonry in the USA. He has researched in depth and produced a wonderfully readable book, definitely one for the bookshelf.
And the book is published by Hodder and Stoughton at 487 pages, price £25. So we come to the final book in this section, The Hermetic Art of Memory by Alexander Dixon. Not sealed off at all. Hard to find texts available once more, is the strapline. Reviewed by Julian Perry. To some, the word hermetic means sealed off or hard to understand. But to anyone interested in the philosophy that developed during and after the Renaissance, it means ideas based on the supposedly ancient writings of one Hermes Trismegistus. Far from being opaque, these writings are basically about good conduct and piety, and they struck a deep chord with many religious thinkers. Alexander Dickson was one of these. Born in Scotland in 1558, Dickson became a leading disciple of the Italian friar Giordano Bruno, who was also a philosopher, poet, mathematician, cosmological theorist, and memory expert. Typical fare for a Renaissance scholar who was steeped in hermetic thinking. What has this got to do with Freemasonry? On a general level, Hermetic ideas were arguably one of the many strands that contributed to early Freemasonry becoming speculative. This book, however, deals specifically with the Hermetic art of memory, something many Renaissance thinkers were deeply attracted to. It involved creating an imaginary building in the mind, whose rooms could be filled with objects that could be then used to trigger memories. Done in the right way, it was said to be powerful, easy to use, and accurate. Freemasonry, certainly in England, Scotland, and Ireland, involves a lot of learning by heart. Moreover, few of us, if any, are trained actors. Many years ago, I found creating an imaginary building helped more than just cramming my lines parrot fashion, so by chance I used a kind of memory palace decades before I ever heard about the art of memory. This book brings together the texts of two of Dixon's books in a fresh translation. Perhaps something for the more hard-boiled Masonic scholar, I nonetheless enjoyed it and will definitely refer to it again. It might even help me learn my lines better. And the book, The Hermetic Art of Memory by Alexander Dixon, is published by Lewis Masonic, 287 pages, price £15. In the charity section, we start with Focusing on the Future, the Freemasons' collective charity response to COVID-19, and then we turn to Pillars of Support and some short stories on how the MCF was supported by its fundraisers during 2021. An article entitled A Second Wave of Support, another one entitled Service and Dedication, and finally, Volunteers Dial Up Their Support, and an open letter from Victoria.
On page 65, Focusing on the Future. The Freemasons' collective charity response to COVID-19 has been unprecedented. As Big Ben struck midnight, Auld Lang Syne welcomed in a new year, and hopes and wishes for a healthy, prosperous, and positive 2020 were shared between loved ones across the world. Of course, you do not need a reminder of the reality that 2020 brought to millions of families, both at home and overseas, an unexpected situation that we are still experiencing today. For many charities across England and Wales, COVID-19 led to the closure of their doors, some temporarily while staff adhered to lockdown, some permanently as they succumbed to loss of funding. For the Masonic Charitable Foundation, MCF, the Freemasons' charity, home offices popped up overnight and phone lines remained open for individuals and charities who needed support and services more than ever. This achievement can be entirely credited to the generosity and dedication of Freemasons across England and Wales, who stepped up to support the MCF in delivering Freemasonry's charitable response to COVID-19. The MCF allocated more than £2.75 million to frontline initiatives supporting the most vulnerable members of the community, with an additional £1 million raised through the Freemasons' COVID-19 Community Fund. An incredible sum achieved in just 16 weeks. From the MCF's existing funds, over £2.6 million in grants was given to more than 1,460 Freemasons or their families who had been directly impacted by the pandemic. However, while it seems intuitive to reflect on the pandemic in this issue, the MCF invites you to look forward with them, to leave the troublesome COVID-19 narrative for a while and discover the exciting developments and new announcements that are to come from your charity in the year ahead. From new charitable projects to the launch of fundraising spectacles, from continued mental health support to helping bereaved families, read on to see how the MCF is picking up where it left off and helping Freemasonry to continue building better lives.
Now we come to some short stories. Entitled, loosely, Pillars of Support. Earlier this year, the Masonic Charitable Foundation turned to social media to find out how its fundraisers would be supporting its work in 2021. The response was overwhelming, from beard growing to marathons and everything in between. Freemasons are putting their feet on the pedals when it comes to raising money and making a difference. Here are a few of the MCF's favourite stories.
Old Men and Their Mountains, 2021. Province, Derbyshire. Who? Worshipful Brother Tony Harvey, Past Assistant Grand Director of Ceremonies. The background. In 2018, with his 60th birthday fast approaching, Tony decided to set himself a challenge, to walk the Old Man of Coniston, the 2,632-foot mountain in Cumbria's Lake District. To some, this would have been a pleasant hike during a summer holiday, but for Tony, the prospect was overwhelming after a debilitating accident and subsequent surgery left him unable to walk 500 feet. Spurred on by his family, fellow Freemasons, and his wider friendship circle, Tony achieved his goal and spent his 60th birthday on a very wet and windy summit with 15 supporters cheering him on. The bonus? Tony raised an incredible £4,163 for the MCF and Derbyshire's 2025 Festival Appeal. Inspired by his last walk, Tony has gone on to recruit a team of Derbyshire Freemasons and has set his sights on Yorkshire's Three Peaks Challenge. This is a 24-mile circular route, climbing a total of 5,200 feet, all in the name of fundraising. Good luck, and remember, gentlemen, left foot forwards.
Sportsman's Dinner 2021. The province is Leicestershire and Rutland. Who? Well, 500 Freemasons and their guests. And the background. Leicestershire and Rutland's Sportsman's Dinners have played host to some of sport's biggest names, from cricketer Phil Tufnell to rugby union hooker Brian Moore. In 2017, a dinner with Moore attracted more than 500 Freemasons and members of the local community, raising £40,000 towards their 2022 festival appeal. In 2019, dinner with guest speaker Tufnell hosted more than 700 guests and raised £70,000 towards the festival. Leicestershire and Rutland's events team are pulling out all the stops for the 2021 Sportsman's Dinner, with former Liverpool and England footballer Kevin Keegan set to join them as guest speaker. With the return of their famous charity auction, they hope to match the amount raised in 2019 and bring their festival appeal even closer to its target.
London to Paris Cycle Ride. Province, Durham. Who? 31 cyclists and 6 support drivers. The background. Throughout their 2021 festival appeal, Durham cyclists have always been one wheel ahead in their commitment to fundraising. Their last 3 cycle rides have raised more than £80,000 towards their festival appeal, including £27,500 raised by 28 avid cyclists who took on the challenge of riding from Edinburgh to Durham. In addition to supporting their 2021 festival, 14 cyclists recently covered 100 miles in one day, which raised more than £5,000 for the Freemasons' COVID-19 Community Fund. Not to be outdone by their previous achievements, 2021 will see 31 cyclists and 6 support drivers make the trip from Freemasons Hall in London to the Eiffel Tower in Paris, in the hope of bringing their fundraising total to an astounding £100,000. The MCF can always count on Durham cyclists to support their work in building better lives.
A second wave of support. In March 2020, the Masonic Charitable Foundation partnered with UGLE to provide £2.75 million in immediate and much-needed relief to charitable causes and individuals as the coronavirus crisis unfolded. As support spread throughout the provinces, it was uplifting to see the positive impact of Freemasonry's funding and volunteering on communities most affected. Now, the time has come for the second phase of Freemasons' charitable response to COVID-19, helping those worst affected to recover. This next phase of the Freemasons' COVID-19 Community Fund programme of grants consists of an additional £2.1 million, of which MCF contributed £1 million, funding to contribute to the rehabilitation phase of the pandemic. The programme is open to both registered charities and charitable causes, and projects which can demonstrate that they're able to be scaled up and applied in multiple regions are particularly welcome. The second phase of the Freemasons' COVID-19 Community Fund focuses on 3 different areas of society in need of support. The MCF has worked together with UGLE and provincial representatives to identify these areas and discussed where funding should be directed and how. The first round focused on helping those affected by homelessness and rough sleeping. Successful applicants are being awarded from December with grants from £10,000 to £100,000. To find out more about the MCF's charity grants programme and to apply, you can go to mcf.org.uk.
Service and dedication. The Masonic Charitable Foundation has appointed Dr. Simon Fellerman to its board of trustees. Simon has also become chairman of the charity's Masonic Support Committee. He has been a member of the committee since it was formed, and prior to that he was on the board of trustees at the Masonic Samaritan Fund. His appointment follows the retirement of John Hornblow, who has been a trustee of the MCF since it was established in 2015. Also retiring from the MCF board is another founding trustee, Christopher White. Before joining the MCF board, Christopher was a council member for the Royal Masonic Trust for Girls and Boys. He will continue to support the Masonic charities as a trustee of the RMBI Care Company. James Newman, OBE, Deputy President and Chairman of the MCF, said, "John and Chris have been very generous with their time and experience over many years, and have provided the MCF and the other Masonic charities with valuable guidance. Everyone at MCF thanks them both for their long and dedicated service to our charity."
Volunteers dial up their support. Having spent months supporting Freemasons and their families without the help of the Visiting Volunteers, VVs, the Masonic Charitable Foundation's Masonic Support Team has adapted the grants application process so that VVs can carry out their essential role again without endangering their health or that of applicants. The VV programme was launched in 2016 to help make the application process as easy as possible for Freemasons and their families. Since then, hundreds of VVs across England and Wales have passed their training and carried out thousands of home visits to help people complete their applications for MCF support. But in March, the MCF stopped home visits in order to protect VVs and the people they support. Over the next few months, the Masonic Support Team worked hard to adapt the application process and prepare VVs for their new role as virtual visiting volunteers. This was facilitated by a new online training hub, which has allowed the VVs to access all the information they need from the safety of their own home. More than 100 VVs have completed their online training and are once again working with applicants via phone. This could not have come at a better time as the country faces a second wave. As more and more VVs complete their online training, including brand new recruits, the capacity of the MCF's Masonic Support Team continues to grow. The MCF is looking with hope to the future. Despite tough times ahead, it'll be more than prepared to support Freemasons and their families with the expertise, efficiency and compassion that they have rightly come to expect.
An open letter from Victoria. Worshipful Brother Geoffrey Quinn's daughter thanks the MCF for support. In January 2018, my father, Worshipful Brother Geoffrey Quinn, became very poorly and spent a considerable amount of time in York Hospital. As a single mum with a 10-year-old son and working full-time, my life turned upside down overnight. I found myself doing a 100-mile round trip every weekend and evenings, visiting my father in hospital, caring for him and meeting with consultants. During this time, I was lucky to receive support from Worshipful Brother David Marsh, Almoner of the Mitre Lodge of York, number 7321. David and his wife Sue were always on hand to offer support and still are to this day. Sadly, my father passed away on the 18th of June 2018. In the same week, I was visited by a member of the Masonic Charitable Foundation to see if I was eligible for support. When I was informed about the MCF, I was extremely embarrassed to ask for any help. I have always tried to stand on my own two feet, supporting my son on my own. I am not a person who likes to ask for assistance. I was overwhelmed when the MCF came back to me to advise that we were eligible for a grant and that my son, Ethan, would receive support for both his education and out-of-school activities. Since losing my father, the MCF has continued to support Ethan with his education and extracurricular activities, for which we are extremely grateful. With the closure of schools in March 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic, Ethan was able to continue carrying out his schoolwork from home with his laptop and office software, kindly provided by the MCF. He has also been able to continue playing the sports he loves with his friends, particularly football, and again the MCF makes this possible for him. Last Christmas, Ethan received a donation from the Freemasons charity of Yorkshire North and East Ridings to enable him to buy something of his choice. He chose to put this towards a new bicycle because he had outgrown his old one. Losing a loved one and coping with bereavement is extremely difficult for anyone. Without the support of the MCF, the last couple of years would have been a struggle, and especially more recently with the current pandemic. Receiving this kind and generous support takes the weight off my shoulders and ensures that Ethan has the tools needed to have the best possible education, continue playing sports and activities he loves with his friends, maintain his mental well-being, and do his grandfather proud. Thank you once again for everything you do for us.
Now we come to the letters section of the magazine, letters to the editor. And if you want to write, you write to the editor, FMT, Freemasons Hall, Great Queen Street, London, WC2B5AZ, or email editor@freemasonrytoday.com. And a note at the bottom of the page says the opinions expressed here are those of the authors and do not necessarily reflect the views of the United Grand Lodge of England. All UGLE members' letters printed are appended with the contributor's name, his mother lodge name and number, the town where that lodge meets and the province. Please include these details at the foot of your letter. Please enclose a stamped addressed envelope for any items sent by mail that you wish to have returned. The first letter is from Roger Earthroll from La Tolerance, number 538. He says, "Sir, having just read the Thesaurus, it brought back lovely childhood memories. As a child, I lived in Brockley. My siblings and I were all christened in St. Peter's Church on the corner of Upper Cranfield Road and Wickham Road, which I assume the lodge was named after. I eventually joined the 8th Brockley St. Peter's Scout Group, which met in St. Peter's Hall.
Sir, I am a Freemason of 55 years standing and have to take issue with the unrealistic expectations of Brother Lohmann's letter, FMT Autumn 2020. He focused on three issues, quality of ceremonies, interviewing of candidates, and honours, on which I comment below. Quality of ceremonies. Freemasons come from all sections of our community. Some are brilliant at learning and performing the ritual, but that is a tiny minority. Most find it a real challenge for a number of reasons, among them the ability to absorb complex wordings, business demands, talent to perform, and nerves. I have seen ceremonies in the range of appalling, poor, and satisfactory. Very occasionally they have been good, but never excellent. They are no different today than when I first became a Freemason, nor has there been any deterioration in the overall high quality of brethren performing them. The problem is, too much depends on the ability of brethren to learn the ritual. I have long held the view that should be removed, and modern technology used as far as possible to enable the words to be read. LOIs or rehearsals could then concentrate on understanding the ritual and delivering a high-quality, sincere ceremony. The days of candidates being confronted with faltering and prompted brethren and those watching cringing with embarrassment should be behind us. Interviewing. The interview process is quite thorough but subjective, and the end results are no different than in the past. However good a prospective member appears to be, no one can be sure how they will respond to Freemasonry. The most important factor is brethren acting responsibly and recommending suitable people. That has always been the case and will remain so. Honours. I am a member of both London and provincial lodges and am probably unqualified to comment on honours as I have never passed the rank of Master Mason. However, in my experience, those with honours have committed a great deal to the craft and are extremely worthy and deserving. I accept there are sometimes issues over priority in making awards, but they resolve themselves. This letter reflects my personal views and not those of either of my lodgers. Yours fraternally, Doug Johnston, St. Peter Port, Guernsey. Fidelity Lodge No. 1809, Guernsey. Cantium Lodge No. 6397, London.
And this final letter comes from Gary Hawkes of Burnbeck Lodge 7160, Somerset Provincial Team 2019/2020. Sir, first, may I congratulate you and all the contributors for such an illuminating read in the autumn edition of FMT. Second, I have just finished digesting the autumn copy and particularly the letters to the editor page. I have to confess to being saddened when I read of the observations of Brother David Lohman of St. Thomas Lodge with regards to his experiences of a laissez-faire approach to learning and deliverance of ceremonial and ritual. My experience, fortunately, has been very much more positive, and I thought I would share my experiences in my own lodge and as part of the Somerset Provincial Team. I'm very privileged to be the DC in my lodge. We have a number of more junior, in terms of Masonic experience, members who put much time and effort into learning their ritual and improving their ceremonies, and it's a pleasure to see and hear them perform. I also had the honour to be appointed as a Deputy Provincial DC and Acting Provincial DC last year. I had the extreme honour of working with a superb team who displayed humour and fun during provincial visits, but also delivered excellent ritual and ceremony and worked extremely hard to make it the very best they could. To my fellow lodge members and the provincial team, it was a matter of personal pride to them to do their very best, and I guess this is the real root of the issue. If we engender pride in well-performed ceremony and obvious effort, the participants will not only grow in stature and knowledge, but be prepared to challenge themselves further and volunteer for more floor work. I'm very proud of our junior lodge members and our 2019/2020 Somerset Provincial Team. I wish I could bottle their enthusiasm, humour, pride and personal effort and send it to Brother David for him to enjoy too. And that brings us to the end of this edition of FMT Magazine, issue number 52 for winter 2020. Thank you for listening.